Coming up on Boston Public Radio, President Trump's approval rating is at an all-time low. The White House has been awash in investigations and internal power struggles since day one. And remember, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. So how is it that Democrats keep losing elections? What is the party not getting right? We're opening the lines and asking you. Veteran national security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us for her take on the death of Otto Warmbier. Is this going to further strain our relationship with North Korea? And if so, what's it going to look like?
I'm Jared Bowen in for Jim Browdy. While free speech has been under attack from college campuses to Shakespeare on the Park, the Supreme Court, in two decisions, has delivered some big victories for free speech. Suffolk Law professor Renee Landers joins us for that. From there, does human behavior translate to animal behavior? With GBH's science editor Heather Goldstone weighing in. That and more next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy has the day off. Jared Bowen is in for him, and he is the executive editor, arts editor here at WGBH. Hello again, Jared.
Hi, Marjorie. Still standing.
I know. We're having fun,
I think.
We are having fun. But a lot of Democrats are having very much fun today, and here is why. President Trump approval ratings are at an all-time low. A new CBS poll finds that a third of Americans say Trump's approach to the Russia investigation has worsened their opinion of him. 63% of Americans disapprove of Trump's response to the Russia investigation. On top of that, you have a White House that has been in turmoil since day one. Infighting, resignations. Senate Republicans are getting criticized by members of their own party for working on a health bill, in secrecy. And then there's the ghost of the 2016 election hanging over the GOP, particularly the West Wing. Hillary Clinton dominated the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes. So, with all of this, how come Democrats keep losing elections in the era of Trump? Republican Ralph Norman won South Carolina's congressional race. Republican Karen Handel won Georgia's House special election. So the hand-wringing, soul-searching, and recriminations kick in again for the Democrats. Our own Seth Moulton tweeted, Ossoff race better be a wake-up call for Democrats. Business as usual isn't working. Time to stop rehashing 2016 and talk about the future. We're opening up the lines and asking you, what should the future of the Democratic Party be? When did it go astray? Is there too much money, too much infighting? Is it being united by mutual hatred for President Donald Trump or not? I mean, this Ossoff thing was supposed to be a big watershed moment for the Democrats. You know, they were hoping $50 million spent in this race against Karen Handel. And the thought was that this could be a big changeup for the Democrats. This could mean that Republicans weren't going to support Donald Trump. They weren't going to support the health bill. They weren't going to support massive tax cuts for the most wealthy, all these things. And he just didn't lose. He got trounced. 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org.
Well, yeah, I think it was interesting to hear everybody talk about that yesterday, how this is definitely shaping up to be a referendum. This, as you just mentioned, this would definitely have an impact on health care and the president going forward. And this is a lesson for the country, is it not? I mean, this is where our country stands, that there are a lot of people who still support the Republican Party who aren't as disenchanted with the president and how the party is acting after the election in these last 5 months. And people want, you know, especially I think that Democrats want the country to believe.
Yeah, well, this is a district, this district in Georgia, outside of Atlanta, suburban district, more well-educated suburban voters. Those are supposedly the voters who are most disenchanted with Donald Trump. And so the thought there was that even though the district has been reliably Republican for a long time, Tom Price, who's now Health and Human Services Secretary, won that district by 23 points the last time around. Even though it had been staunchly Republican for decades, I think since Jimmy Carter, that these are the kinds of voters that have said they are getting disenchanted, that this was a chance for the Democrats to make a stand. And the Democrats pumped $25 million into this race for John Ossoff. Now, there's fighting among the Democrats because the whole warrior versus high priest, as I think the Washington Post put it, you know, Ossoff was not the warrior. He was not the Bernie Sanders on fire. I'm filled with righteous outrage kind of candidate. He wanted civility. He wanted humility. He hardly ever mentioned Trump. Karen Handel, the Republican, hardly ever mentioned Trump. But some Democrats were saying he just wasn't the right kind of candidate. It was also interesting how they linked him to Pelosi in all these ads, to Nancy Pelosi.
Yep. And that they couldn't – yeah, exactly. And that the Democrats weren't using her either. And really nobody has in any race because she is such a polarizing figure within the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I mean, and Seth Moulton was one of the guys that was leading the revolt to get rid of Nancy Pelosi and bring in a new speaker. But her disapproval ratings are huge.
What I do find perplexing here is sort of the yo-yo of this election, though, that Ossoff had gotten – he had done so well in the preliminary election that he almost avoided having a runoff. That would have given him this, and yet now he wakes up today or last night, realized that he was going to wake up today, not going to Washington, and that he hadn't surfaced the way everybody thought he was going to.
And it was not even that close. So our number is 877-301-8970. If you are a Democrat, are you thinking it's hopeless? It's all over. The Democrats need 24 seats to regain a majority in the House in 2018. So far, it's 3-3, and the Dems have lost every one. And this is the most painful, I suppose, because it was the one where the Democrats most thought they had a chance. Do you want to have a righteously indignant, full of fire and brimstone candidate like a Bernie Sanders who's going to take on the president head on? Or do you want a more let's all work together, build a coalition, let's be civil kind of candidate, which is what Ossoff was. It didn't succeed for him. Maybe it could succeed for somebody else. And if you're a Republican, this is a happy day for you. You saw a district that wasn't really happy. By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this, but Trump did not win by much in this district. This was not a place where he was very popular in 2016, which is why the Democrats thought they had a chance. But do you see this as a vindication of the president that Russia be damned, you know, Michael Flynn's problems be damned, healthcare secrecy, we don't care, we're still going to hang with the GOP no matter what? 877-301-8970.
All right, let's go to Francis in the car. Hi, Francis.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I don't think – thank you. Love your show.
Thank you.
First of all, no Democrat should panic because we lost an election in Georgia, you know, whereas, you know, since Sam Nunn, you know, it's not like, you know, this is Newt Gingrich's and Tom Price, that wonderful guy that's working on – removing health care for half of the population. I don't think we need to freak out at this point in time. I think the infighting amongst the party is real, and that, you know, it'll work itself out. But if you lose in South Carolina and Georgia, we're going to freak out? Come on. If we lose in Boston, then we freak out. You know what I mean?
By the way, the guy in South Carolina, Archie Parnell, he only lost by 3 points. So he did better than John Ossoff did in Georgia. That was kind of interesting. And the Democrats didn't put any money behind Archie Parnell, not very much, because they were focusing on Ossoff. So that's a great point you raise.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'm not freaking out today. Trump will keep imploding. I mean, he's not going to get any better. He's going to keep getting worse and worse, and the numbers will get better and better for the Democrats. Let's not panic, you know, really. That's my opinion, my humble opinion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. As I said before, the Democrats have got to get 24 seats to change the makeup in the House to be have a majority in the House. I don't think there's much chance they're going to get anywhere in the Senate, but the House seems to be. And you do sort of wonder. I mean, I'm interested to hear what Democrats think. Do they want somebody that's going to be just, you know, turn Trump into a pinata, or do they want someone? Seth Moulton has talked more about, you know, we need a positive economic message. It can't just be anti-Trump. We need a vision. We need a bigger tent, all that kind of stuff. I mean, is that what the Democrats need? And or maybe there's more people that just like what Trump is doing. They like I don't get why many people would like this healthcare thing. I just don't get that.
Well, you're saying this, and I'm thinking also we've seen here in Massachusetts, Seth Moulton has been pretty strong in language. He's been a fighter here, mm-hmm. not unlike Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren, I mean, she was pretty intense in meeting Trump in terms of tweets and language over the course of the election. I mean, and these are two people who really are considered the top echelon of the party at this point. They are the strategy to follow. They are the people to follow. So they've been there, which is the opposite, exactly, as you mentioned earlier, of what Ossoff has yeah. done, which was, again, run this campaign just based on civility and not being the warrior that, of course, quarterbacking is always going to happen, the Monday morning quarterbacking, yeah. And that's why he's being faulted, along for the fact that he didn't actually was no longer living in the district that he was supposed to be representing. That's a minor point. Of course, he did grow up there, and for reasons yeah. of his marriage, was living outside the district. But that yeah. didn't help.
And he was a young guy, 30 years old, didn't have a lot of experience. I don't know that he was the most inspiring of speakers, but neither is she. I mean, Karen Hale is sort of the perennial candidate. She's run for a million different things, and she's a perennial politician. She, though, distanced herself from the president as well. I mean, at her speech last night, her victory speech, people were all chanting Trump, 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 Trump. But that's not where she went during her campaign. She barely mentioned him. Let's go to Jack in Dighton. Hi, Jack.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
Great.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I will say this. The Democratic Party does not have a focused message. I mean,
yeah.
I can't even tell you what their message is right now. They seem to be all over the place. And I was not surprised by yesterday's election results in Georgia. And I will also say that, you know, I don't know if I believe the poll. Like, these are the same polls that told us that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and the same polls that said that, you know, Maura Healey was going to win. And it seems to be wrong every time.
Well, Maura Healey did win, remember?
Martha Coakley.
Martha Coakley.
Oh, Martha Coakley. Martha Coakley.
Yeah, well, 15 points. She's winning by 15 points to Brown, and then Brown's win. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, well, you know, the national polls on the election were pretty close, in fairness. They were like 2 or 3 points, right? The state polls in those three states, Wisconsin and Michigan, were pretty far off. But the national polls weren't that far off, Jack. But you're absolutely right about Martha Coakley. I remember 2 weeks before the election, she was ahead by 15 points.
They reported, but I don't know that she was, because you don't lose 15 points in 14 days.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember who did that poll.
Again, I think they need to focus their message there.
So what would be a good message, Jack?
Well, the message seems to be we hate Trump, anybody but Trump, but the American people seem to be saying something different, and they're not listening to the American people, and those are the people that vote.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the call. But on the other hand, the American people are disenchanted. I know Jack doesn't believe the polls, but I think the polling, frankly, is pretty accurate. I mean,
I couldn't disagree with you more, and I couldn't agree with Jack more, because I think we've seen enough of this happen now,
yeah.
and to an extent it is media driven, and these narratives are created, and they're not panning out, and we've seen them not pan out over and over and over again, that I found myself, as we approach each election season, probably over the last 2 or 3 years, not believing anything I'm seeing in any of those graphics on screen leading up to it. Yeah, I noticed yesterday when we were speaking with John King how careful he was not to read anything into it, including when I was asking him about early voting, and we were talking to him about what turnout might mean. He was very, very careful, and he was very deliberate, and I think for the same reason. It just seems to be a very fallible system at this point, the exit polling and even the advance polling leading up into the weeks in advance.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I think a lot of us, including myself, made a terrible mistake about the early voting in 2016, Clinton versus Trump, because I think the assumption was that the early voting was going to favor her, and that a lot of Latino voters are going to vote for her, and failed to account for the fact that you've been here 2 or 3 generations. You're Latino. You are not necessarily at all in the Democratic camp. You could be much more conservative than that. So we made that big mistake. But I don't know. I'll stand by the Scott Brown was a shocker. He was definitely a shocker. But I don't think the polls were that off. And they said 2 or 3 points, the national polls. That's what it was, right?
Yeah, but there was also a lot of optimism. Maybe I'm conflating polls with the sort of the media narrative too, because yeah. there was so much optimism around Ossoff. But I'm thinking back to even covering Kerry, John Kerry's presidential election night, and everybody had him winning that night too. So going back, how many years ago was that?
And, that was awful.
And Copley Square, what was complete euphoria turned into just the most dispiriting for that crowd, that most depressing, sending poor Jon Bon Jovi out to perform just to keep people from, I think, collapsing on the spot. So
remember one of his aides turned to John Kerry and said, "Congratulations, Mr. President." And then a half hour later, he was no longer Mr. President. Yeah. Oh, that was bad. That was bad. 877-301-8970. What do the Democrats do to win? Or is it just hopeless? Should they just give up now? And no matter what the president does, as he said during the campaign, if he stands out in Fifth Avenue and shoots somebody, it's not going to matter. Maybe he's right and we're all wrong.
That's right. We're asking you why, in the era of Trump, the party can't get its mojo back. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jared Bowen is in for Jim Browdy. Okay, we are talking about the Democrats, who had two big losses yesterday, the GOP winning a House race in Georgia and in South Carolina. If you are a Democrat, what is going on? What is the party getting wrong? Republicans, what do you see here? The Dems clearly do not have a message that's working, and they clearly do not resonate with Republicans, even those Republicans that they thought they had in this race, that is the higher educated, suburban, more diverse Republicans that seem to be disenchanted with Donald Trump, if you can believe the polls, which Jared doesn't believe. So anyway, 877-301-8970 is the number. A couple pieces of sound here I want to play for you. There was the theory that the fact that there was a shooting at the Republicans' baseball game last week did not help the election of the Democrat in Georgia at all. And here's an attack ad claiming that Democrats are endorsing last week's shooting of Congressman Steve Scalise.
Now the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday, because the same unhinged leftists cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff. And if he wins, they win. Stop them. Stop them now. Stop John Ossoff. Stop Nancy Pelosi. Vote Karen Handel for Congress. Vote Principled Leadership Project PAC, paid for this ad and is solely responsible for its content.
Okay, that was a pretty tough ad. Karen Handel distanced herself from that ad because I don't think we found people cheering for the shooting of a congressman. But in any case, I'll play a bit of Tucker Carlson as well. He's got the Bill O'Reilly slot on Fox News. I said Jim O'Reilly there for a second. Bill O'Reilly slot on Fox News at 8 o'clock. Here he is last night talking about why he thinks John Ossoff lost.
Democrats put up a 30-year-old semi-employed documentary filmmaker who can't even vote for himself, because he doesn't live in the district. He's got a ton of trendy rich people positions on just about every topic. The abortion people love him. He's gravely concerned about climate and childhood obesity and the availability of organic kale. He thinks illegal aliens are noble. He went to the London School of Economics. He's super fit and way smarter than you are. We could go on and on. You've seen it all before. That's the point. Voters have seen it before too. And outside of Brooklyn and the west side of LA, they're not that into it. That's why Democrats keep losing.
It's an interesting point, but you think to yourself, you can't get much more patrician than FDR. And I think most people think he was a pretty good president. You can't get much more patrician, even though he was an Irish Catholic, than John Kennedy. He was kind of a wannabe WASP. So it's interesting that a lot of people that we, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, I mean, my goodness. But they patricians?
It's a different time, though. Don't you agree? This is a way different time. The conversation about who our candidates are supposed to be and what their constitution is supposed to be is very different.
Donald Trump is a New York City billionaire who went to the finest schools there are. Right? I mean, he's a silver spoon kind of guy.
But he doesn't talk like that. I think that's the big difference.
So I guess we go back to Bill Clinton.
Yes. who just came out of Arkansas and did not come from a difficult family.
A hayseed from Arkansas. I guess that's where we want to go. Or back to Jimmy Carter. He was sort of a man of the people kind of guy. Our number is 877-301-8970. It looks like the Democrats could be, if this has anything to do with anything, that the 2018 mid-year races the Democrats have been enthusiastic about, maybe a harder thing to achieve wins there than they have been expecting. John from Gardner. Hi, John.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jared. How are we doing?
Hi, great. Thanks for calling.
Marjorie, quickly, what is 26 seconds?
I don't know. What?
That's when I was getting off the golf course the other day, that's how long it took me to determine the gym was off because he didn't interrupt you. God help us, he's out slithering about, huh?
He is slithering about. Who knows what dastardly deeds he's up to.
On the broader question, I think she served her purpose in the day that she's been running the show, and she's a great vote gatherer and vote counter. But Nancy Pelosi has got to go as far as the leadership. Did you notice in that horrendously horrible ad, they threw in a mention of Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, they linked her with him constantly, and she's
right.
Got lousy approval ratings.
Right. In this particular race, you know, my tongue is going to secede from my body when I say this, but Tucker Carlson, even in his understated fashion, is kind of right. This guy was a lousy candidate.
Yeah.
You said he wasn't the most inspiring. Was this some cartoon character named Droopy Dog? I mean, the guy just seemed like you're mature enough to acknowledge that superficiality counts in these things.
Absolutely.
Right?
I'm the queen of superficiality, John.
No, you're a queen of acknowledging it. You're not superficial yourself. And living outside the district, talk about handing the other side on a platter the talking point to beat all talking points. I mean, it's just, if the Supreme Court doesn't, they're about to rule on the gerrymandering issue.
Yes, we're going to talk about that with Renee Landers in just a few minutes. I'm very excited about that.
You and the caller made a good point about South Carolina. I think a big point of bringing out the Republican vote, the pro-Trump vote, was all the outside money and how publicized, if you will, this election was as perhaps a bellwether for bigger things. And I think that motivated the people to turn out. South Carolina, that wasn't the case, and it was closer.
Yeah, you know? 3 points there and 5 points with Handel and Ossoff. John, thank you very much for the call. I'll tell Jim that you miss him very much.
26 seconds.
26 seconds,
that was
yeah.
a great call.
Yeah, he's one of our regulars. Ed in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi. I mean, I would say as a Republican, don't change a thing. You're doing great. I'm very pleased. Keep it up. And, you know, your last caller and then the very first caller today, I think his name was Frank, said, you know, he wouldn't panic. If the Democrats are going to become more competitive in places like Georgia, they're going to have to be less competitive in places like Boston. And that is the problem. It really isn't a political party anymore. It's sort of morphing into a kind of private club, or I think at the fringes, really like a religion or a cult. You know, you cannot have discussions within the Democratic Party about issues, because if you don't toe the line, absolutely, immediately the name-calling starts, and immediately you're basically excommunicated. I'll give you one statistic that
what?
I really ought to concern Democrats.
What?
In this millennium, if you go back to 2000, okay, the Senate turns over every 6 years. So you've had three complete turnovers in the last, I guess it's nine, you know, biennial elections of the U.S. Senate. Do you know how many sitting Democrat senators running for reelection have faced a primary challenge in the last nine cycles?
No, I don't.
One.
Huh.
Joe Lieberman, Ned Lamont, whenever it was. I think it was 2006.
But Ed,
that is a sign of a party that just is not interested in change, or is even interested in debate.
But Ed, you could say the same thing about the GOP being really divided between the Freedom Caucus and the moderates. I mean, that's why we're having this endless fight about the health care bill. Rand Paul and his side basically think that the government has no business in anybody's health care, and the other side is more moderate. So they're split as well, are they not?
Right. That's my whole point, that there is a split within the Republican Party that you cannot there is a breadth of debate that is allowed inside the Republican Party.
Okay.
And you don't have a correspond. For example, if I were to sit down with a bunch of Republicans and say, let's talk about the border wall. How much would it cost? What would it do? How many people would it stop from coming in? You know, how many people would... If I were to sit down with Democrats and say, let's talk about the border wall, the very idea of a border wall gets you kicked out of the Democratic Party.
That's a great point.
You wouldn't get two votes. You wouldn't be allowed in. Look at what they did to Melissa DeFranco when she ran against Elizabeth Warren. Look at what they did to Bernie Sanders. This is not really a political party anymore. And the people, and a lot of them are listeners and donors and guests on this radio station, I think that's just fine with a lot of the people who control the Democrat Party today. And it's fine with me, because they're going to keep losing.
Okay, thank you for the call. I think Melissa DeFranco was a little bit out there in some of her positions. I should go back and refresh myself. But I remember feeling that way at the time, but I could be mistaken.
Although, of course, Seth Moulton did do that, but not that he's in the Senate, but a congressman.
What do you mean?
When he challenged.
Oh, when he challenged John Tierney.
Yeah, exactly.
that was a great point. But, you know, to Ed's point, before Seth Moulton came along, people may remember John Tierney was a congressman for many, many years in the North Shore. Seth Moulton, as you said, just beat him. But his wife was involved in a pretty terrible scandal involving, you know, offshore money laundering and claiming she didn't know anything about that. And Democrats hung with him the first time around, and they had a very good Republican candidate running against him at the time, and the Democrats hung with Tierney instead of saying maybe John, it's time to go. So
there was a lot of frustration in the party that there would be a challenger, especially Massachusetts, where that's not very much done.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Lisa in Canton, what do you think?
Hi, it's Anna Lisa.
Pardon me?
It's Anna Lisa.
Oh, okay. Anna, sorry. Okay. Sorry.
That's okay. I'm in a very interesting spot. I've been listening to this show on cable.
Yeah.
And I probably can't say the name of it, but as a Democrat, as a lifelong Democrat, I'm no longer supporting the party. I'm disgusted by how much corporate money goes into it. And so I'm sort of becoming part of this group that's called the Justice Democrats.
Uh-huh.
That, which Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren are sort of, definitely Bernie Sanders is definitely considered to be a Justice Democrat. And it's looking to try to find people that support single health care and also don't take money from big sponsors. And so it's if they have CPACs or they have huge sponsors and not doing just sort of things on social media with having people donate the amount of money that they can, $10, $5 at a time, it's not worth supporting them because they're not supporting the people. They're supporting the the lobbyists.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you for the call. You know, that was the other big debate, whether Ossoff should have been more like Bernie Sanders, whether he should have been more like Elizabeth Warren, a fiery, you know, righteously indignant candidate as opposed to Mr. Civility and Mr. Humility and, I guess, Mr. Boring.
Well, I guess he knows the answer to that question to this morning. All right, coming up, Alex Beam is here with his famous explainer.
Close enough.
Wow, I cannot speak today.
You sound like me.
No, this is what I get for standing in your spot. And he'll talk about Barbie's Ken getting a major makeover. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is vacationing. Jared Bowen is in for a gym, and he, of course, is the executive arts editor here at WGBH. And here with us in Studio 3 is Alex Beam. And as we do every time he's here,
we mock him. Yeah, that's right.
We marvel that his name is Alex Beam because his writing, like a roof beam, keeps things elevated. Hello.
Oh,
Alex
my. I would think crashes to the ground and destroys everything.
I think that was absolutely wonderful. And, you know, I'm very happy to see you because even though Jim is on vacation, you came in looking a little bit like Jim today because you and Jim often have this finger in the hair in the electric socket thing where the hair is sticking straight up. You were doing a Jim imitation today.
You know what the great comeback to that is? Who does your hair? General Electric. I use that a lot, actually. It's like one of my four.
I have not heard that
lines.
One.
headlines.
I think you're looking very summery today.
Thank you very much, Jared. I feel, appropriate.
No, you look
seasonally
appropriate. Hawaiian shirt and the whole deal.
I've always loved radio. I mean, what can you say, right?
First day of summer.
You could do it in your briefs. Okay.
So, Alex, I know that you are really hoping that the end of the world does not come this summer because you have a dentist appointment and your wife has a timeshare that week in the house up in New Hampshire. You have these events going on that will get in the way of the end of the world. But apparently, as you say, it's the gift that keeps on giving, and the world is ending again shortly over this eclipse.
Yes. I mean, I've written the same column now 5 or 6 times.
But it's very funny. Very funny. Well, everybody should read it.
You're being a little over-charitable. But, I don't know. Have you guys started focusing on August 21st?
I have. I was at a dinner, and somebody was talking about they're actually traveling so they can be in the best place in the United States to see it.
Yeah. I mean, my friend Bruce, who I don't think is – he's an interesting guy. He reserved, I think, like a year ago. It's basically Interstate 40, but not exactly. But there's this thing called the Path of Totality, which is a curve that runs from Oregon, I guess, to the Carolinas. And, there's going to be some actual journalism done fairly shortly. Like, I mean, you know, rents are very, very high there now. I used
to... You mean an Airbnb thing where people are going to sell their...
You only want to be there for this one day.
Yeah. Well, we should explain. So this is the first major total eclipse, a great eclipse since 1776 in this country.
My God.
And visible only in this country, which is, it's crazy. I mean, I just, when I write a piece like this, it's like a placeholder piece. I sort of want to do it because then when the actual journalists come in and do the real pieces, people say, oh, I think Alex wrote about that a few weeks ago. But it's utterly fascinating. And it is. The 1776 thing is strange.
It is strange.
It's a link to the dawn
of the
Republic.
Could be the beginning. And the end kind of deal.
It's the Trumpocalypse.
So, exactly. Yes, right. Exactly. So since I'm not going anywhere, what will I get to see here in Boston?
Well, I have to answer that twice, if you don't mind, because this guy, David Barron, who's an NPR type, whom I may or may not have known like a quarter century ago, has written a whole book sort of on the eclipse phenomena. Mm-hmm. And he kind of convinced me at the end of our interview that he thinks a lot of people are going to break as the hype develops and like flee to Interstate 40 just to see it.
Really?
Yeah, he thinks people like you and me.
How far is Interstate 40?
Well, it's pretty far away, right?
And where is it?
It's like near Knoxville, Tennessee.
Oh.
It's like way down there.
You can't just hop on over.
No,
yeah, or you could go to Missouri. Again, there's this curve that curves up to the Pacific Northwest. But to answer the question that you asked, which kind of relates, which is we are not going to see the total eclipse here in Boston. In my article, there's a link to an internet widget, and it's just going to be like a partial eclipse, the kind that we've seen several times in our lives.
So I understand that people that have seen these total eclipses, even though we haven't had them for a while, have a profound and life-changing religious or spiritual experience.
Precisely. I guess the entire world in the middle of the day is dark for 2 to 3 minutes. And people do. And that's how I then managed to kind of spin the column over into, because indeed all the nutballs, are saying, there's Christian nutballs, there's other nutballs. There is this end of the world industry that's quite active. And I think it's quite lucrative, actually. And every 2 or 3 years they find a new event. They dip into Revelation, the great, great book of the Bible that has, crazy deranged virgins and monsters with 6,000 heads.
It's a little confounding because there is precedent for eclipses happening around the world, and yet we're still here.
Yeah, we are still here. I kind of gave up on this end of the world stuff after, we had the Y2K, the world was going to end, and then we had the people that were waiting for Halley's Comet to come, and they had to have the certain color sneakers. Remember them?
Well, they all killed themselves. Right?
Yeah, they were going to be killed.
Hail Bop.
It's a little. I'm a little suspicious of all these end of the world.
I know, but it is a good marketing opportunity.
I think it'll catch us when we're least aware, and all of a sudden, poof, like in that TV show.
Not when the lights go out.
Yeah, not with the lights go out. I don't think so. But
what
that
TV show?
The TV show. But the
you
book.
Mean Lost? Or?
No, the people that were snatched away, all of a sudden they disappeared.
Oh, by Parada, by the local guy.
Tom Parada.
Oh, the Leftovers. Yeah.
Leftovers.
I haven't seen that have you seen it?
I haven't seen it either, no.
Oh, okay, now I feel better.
All of a sudden you go home and half the family's gone, including the dog. and you don't know where they've gone.
Well, that would be very sad. The dog was missing.
No, Summer. The dog would be sad. But, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, so do we want to talk about something else now here, Alex Beam?
Okay.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
I love this next story, too.
So every Saturday afternoon or morning, I run my long run, and I follow that up with chocolate milk because that's what you're supposed to do. It's good for muscles, I've been told for years. I choose to believe this. What I choose not to believe is what a huge portion of this country believe, Alex Beam, about chocolate milk.
Tens of millions of Americans believe, and I actually kind of like this, believe that chocolate milk comes from brown cows.
Oh!
And this is sort of part of, well, who knew, right? You really drink chocolate milk?
I do. The person who trained me for my first marathon said that you drink chocolate milk because there's something about it that does something for your muscles right after a long run.
Wow, because my son just ran a marathon and with all due respect, somehow didn't restore himself with chocolate milk.
Yeah, I thought it was the pasta.
Well, that's the night before.
The night before.
Well, I didn't win, so maybe that's why I shouldn't be drinking.
Well, we didn't expect you to win, but the fact that you finished.
Did you run a marathon in China?
No, this is one of my many. I have like all these interchangeable sons that are like puzzle parts, depending on what point I need to make at any given time. This son ran the Los Angeles Marathon.
Oh, good for him.
Which is from Chavez Ravine to the ocean. It's kind of cool,
nice.
Actually. Very beautiful. Anyway, no, this thing about chocolate milk coming from brown cows, which frankly sounds fairly logical to me, is, I guess, part of a larger problem of utter agricultural ignorance in our country. A lot of people don't know that onions is a plant. I mean, if you ask people where peanuts come from, I mean, I think you'd get an interesting variety of answers, right? Including from me. I think it's a tuber that grows like sort of near the surface of the earth.
I don't know. Jimmy Carter's farm is all I know. I don't really know where they come from.
On the one hand, yeah, you can kind of like decry the collective agricultural ignorance of the world. But on the other hand, I don't think like the three of us who probably like go to Whole Foods or something. I'm not sure. We're exactly sure where everything comes from.
I don't know much about agriculture at all.
Well, and there was that story in the Globe today about asparagus. And I realized it shoots up from the ground, right? Now that I think about it, because I think I've passed by fields where white asparagus is growing.
I have no idea.
Yes,
about
asparagus does. But that's a I was going to mention avocado. I mean, basically anything that begins with A is like I happen to know that avocados grow on trees, but you could be forgiven for thinking that avocado comes from like where potatoes come from.
Exactly.
Don't you think?
Well, you have to go to places where you see it. You know, I remember when the first time I went to California, I was stunned to see like lemons growing on trees. I mean, my God.
Well, also, I mean, I don't want to belabor this, but like nuts. I know I already mentioned peanuts, but like where do pistachios come from? Where do these other nuts come from?
I have no idea. Where do they come from?
It's a tree.
That's the correct answer.
Pistachio tree? Really?
Well, we're going back to the interstates. But if you drive Interstate 5 in California, from LA to San Francisco.
What about cashews?
That's a great question. I have no idea where
cashews. What about pine nuts? Macadamia nuts?
Okay, we know where pine nuts come from.
Have you seen Best in Show? That's one of the best lines in Best in Show.
It is, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah, with the guy with the bloodhound. He's big into nuts, and he's driving out to go to Best in Show with his bloodhound from some place in Appalachia or something.
Apparently, Brazil nuts, you know, add like 10 years to your life.
Are they from Brazil?
I'm thinking, but if you only have to eat 3 a day, and then you'll almost live forever,
and you'll survive the eclipse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You'll live to see the rapture 6 years from now.
Now, Alex, I find it hard to believe that you put any cotton and any stock into one of these studies.
Which studies?
Any of them.
I don't.
Butter's good, butter's bad.
They're endless fodder for columns. Although I can give you a preview of a forthcoming column. I've spent and we can maybe use this to segue to one of my favorite subjects, quote unquote, broad Ken. But I was on the internet, I found a takedown of the BMI. And I've actually written takedowns of the BMI based on other people's research. But I think there may be a more or less semi-definitive takedown of the body mass index, the notorious body mass index.
Yeah.
Which has enslaved people like me into thinking that we're broad, the new euphemism for fat.
So does this mean that we are less obese as a nation or more obese than we thought?
You know, I haven't actually done the work to find out what it's like something about low density fat index. It's new mumbo jumbo, but that's the columnist's friend. New mumbo jumbo.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I look forward to looking into this.
All of these food
studies. So I'm kicking the ball to you, broad Ken.
Well, should we talk about Ken as we know it is, well, multiplied, I guess. I was going to say no more, but he's expanded. He's multiplied. He has new morphed. Style.
He's merved. Yeah. He's a multiple.
What's happened to Ken?
Well, I don't know. There's this fascinating article in GQ, about the new Ken, who is he's like Starbucks, right? He's like any color you want him. It's really like kind of like those great handbags I always wanted, where you could go to the website and choose your colors. I'm embarrassed. I'm blanking right now. But yeah, Ken comes in like a multiplicity of colors, hairstyles.
Yep.
And for me, a multiplicity of body types now. Three primary body types. I guess there's skinny fit Ken, normal Ken, and then this great euphemism. They were going to call him... it turns out the designer was going to call him post-holiday Ken with this huge beer gut.
Yeah.
But then there's this moment. This
Beefy, they call him.
They call him Broad.
Broad, okay.
You guys cannot relate to this. Going to the Husky section of Sears.
Oh, Jim is not here. Yeah, he was always in the big boy section.
Yeah, I think he could relate to it. I mean, your mom. I mean, this is, wow. I mean, this is like therapy, on-air therapy for me. Your mom takes you and says, honey, I think we're going to have to go over here to the Husky section.
It's like, God.
Oh, my God. But they vetoed that for the new Ken doll that comes with different hair colors, different hairstyles, different skin colors. They wouldn't call him Husky Ken because they realized no one would buy it. But he's called Broad Ken.
Well, how is it that Barbie got to change so much over the years, but this is the first time that Ken has been addressed?
Yeah,
that's a very good question, because she's had a million different skin colors, a million different professions. She's
careers,
always,
yeah.
Career,
yeah.
She's always starting. You know, Diane White, who used to be one of my favorite columnists at the Boston Globe, I absolutely loved her. I remember she wrote a great column, I think it was the 50th anniversary of Barbie or something. And she said, you know, poor Barbie, it's a tragedy that all of America can understand. It's been 50 years now. And Ken has still failed to commit.
Ken won't commit. But the answer to your question, Jared, is they've changed the mark. Ken was really just an appendage. This is hilarious in a way. Minus an appendage.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, I know. He was the appendage-less appendage.
That's right. We always used to take Ken's pants off to see what was going on there when we were little.
And what was going on there?
Nothing much. It was sort of a little extended piece of plastic.
That's the story of the modern woman.
There was a lot more going on with Barbie than there was going on with Ken. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and then this story is it's in GQ. It's utterly fascinating. I guess it turns out that for young girls who basically bought Barbie and then would buy Ken, it turns out that the toilet seat was like a big clue. Is that when you bought all the stuff for Ken and Barbie? It turns out that they had a toilet seat that went up and down, and that was a clue to young girls that there were two ways of evacuating.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I don't recall my Barbie dream house having a toilet in it. I suppose maybe it did. I don't know.
Yes, it did. And then they put in a lid, and that was sort of a hint. Well, there weren't too many other hints, but a hint that Ken had a different
use. And she had a sidekick. Was her name Skipper? Was that Barbie's sidekick? I think so.
Yeah, I guess so. I always just kind of assumed that Ken was, you know, he was that friend, the friend that she takes when she needs to go out for brunch, or the friend that needs to help her pick out her bridesmaid's dress, or, you know, I thought he was that friend.
He is that friend. And that's addressed in this. I mean, Mattel, I actually, you know, when I read this lengthy piece, I was wondering why the Democratic Party doesn't, in a sense, enlist these Mattel marketing people, because Mattel cares only about one thing, which is selling these plastic dolls, right? And the Democratic Party, you know, we're speaking the day after a somewhat regrettable loss. I mean, it should be in the business, really, of just selling one thing, which is trying to win elections.
Yeah, and it's a struggle at the moment.
A struggle. So it looks like Mattel might have this under control. But again, to address a question you raise, Ken and Barbie kind of aren't doing it, right? And but that's worked. That's worked now for 60 years.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's what men and women want, is just to be friends.
Until you add the man bun. That's a game changer.
That's right. There is no man bun here.
No,
they have a Ken with a man
bun? There's a Ken
with
a man bun.
Yes,
oh, my goodness. That's good, because I kind of like
I
those
never
man
know
buns.
What the man bun stands for.
So I don't know either, but yeah, I sort of like them.
I'm going to hold it up to you on radio so
oh,
that
thank
nobody
you.
Who's listening
oh,
can see.
Yes.
But
and that's the light cappuccino can, I believe. Yes. Oh, my God.
Okay, so there's this piece in The Atlantic, Alex Beam, and that's what we're talking to, by the way. Alex Beam, who joins us every week. That a whole long piece about power causes brain damage. This seems to be one long diatribe against Donald Trump. Is this what this is really about?
That was actually, it's a pretty interesting piece. I don't actually go for these weird pieces in The Atlantic that have psychological edge to them. But this seems to indicate that it's mostly about men. I mean, this particular
yes, it
piece,
is.
It's mostly about men. And it's about how, as men accrete or gather power, they lose their mirroring ability. I must say there's a lot of truth to this.
Like Henry Kissinger thinking he was a sex symbol because he was very powerful in the Nixon
administration. Yeah, although I thought that was a poor example because beautiful women slept with Henry Kissinger. So isn't that partially on the beautiful women?
Well, I don't know, but it certainly means that he believed he was sexually magnetic.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. You're right.
Okay.
It was a 50-50 kind of thing.
Yeah, because I always questioned Jill St. John's judgment there. I thought, like, but anyway. Okay, that's a whole
that's
separate thing.
Excellent point.
Well, thank you. But this piece, to be, and I think it's important. It's kind of, it goes to the psychopathology and this. Remember, there's been even two books written about how people in power are sort of psychotic and have psychotic delusions. This is a little bit more subtle and says that when people attain power, they lose the ability to quote unquote mirror, or empathize, or indulge in empathy, or in the simplest possible term, you know, walk that mile in the other person's moccasins. But when you think about it, that has to be a concomitant to power, right? Like when I was younger, I used to talk to my male friends and I said, you know, if you want to be successful in business, you've got to be able to fire people. And to be painfully blunt, that's exactly true. And yet to fire people, right, you have to disassociate yourself from those women and men's pain. So in a crude way, I think that's what this psychological piece is saying, that to have power, you have to exist in a non-mirrored universe where it's not only you can't imagine what it feels like to get fired, but frankly, it's quite useful for you to not be able to imagine what it's like to get fired.
Well, more than psychological, there are neuroscientists involved here, right, who say that there actually is a chemistry change within the brain once you become powerful.
And they also say...
I wonder what that feels like.
It makes you more impulsive and less risk-aware. Which I think, you know, it seems to me this whole piece dissecting the head of Donald Trump, that this is what this is really about, isn't it?
Well, you might be right. I have to say I didn't read it that way because the big example that they use at the head of the piece is this guy John Stumpf.
Yep.
You know, from
Wells Fargo.
Yep. And they link to a video of him appearing. And it is, I mean, I'm not taking away what you're saying because, of course, Trump was a corporate executive. But corporate executives have always interested me in a complicated way. And, of course, to me, the whole thing about pay is very, very interesting because corporate executives live in a world where actually they don't care what you're paid. They care what that person over there who runs IBM is paid. So that's another example where they have a very specific psychology where they've kind of completely lost contact with like what it feels like to make $47,000. They're much more interested in, you know, and it's true of women also. You know, the woman, Marissa Mayer at Yahoo takes away, what, $317 million for doing a crappy job. But it's really, to her, it's much more relevant. What is Sergey Brin making? Like, not like, what does this person at Yahoo make, et cetera, et cetera. It's an interesting piece.
My favorite case here was Winston Churchill, where his wife Clementine wrote this letter to him. My darling Winston, I must confess that I have noticed a deterioration in your manner and you are not as kind as you used to be. She writes this on the day that Hitler entered Paris. So you can argue that dear Winston was slightly conflicted that day and distracted.
That was an amazing example. Of course, that's the downside of marrying an American. That was his mistake. You know? And then the other incredible thing was that the head of Pepsi-Cola is basically a youngish woman, and she's from a traditional Indian family, and she comes home to tell her mom that she's become chairman of PepsiCo, which is a fairly bleeping big deal, and her mom says, would you please go out and pick up some food for me? It's dinner time. And boy, yeah, parents can, shall we say, bring one down very quickly. Mm.
So we only have 3 minutes left, so I don't know, maybe we should just go right to the explainer as opposed to talking about the Supreme Court and the First Amendment.
Yeah, I know. Oh, the Slants and the Redskins. It's better that we don't talk about that, even though it's awfully interesting. It was a unanimous Supreme Court decision, which as a citizen makes me happy. And B, I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I'm pro-Redskins, so maybe it's better we just not go there.
Yeah, we're going to talk at some point with Renee Landers about this as well, from our Supreme Court's analysis of this whole thing. So tell us what your explainer is, please. Ask people. Now, you can explain what your explainer is, and then, well, just tell us the topic before you get into the explainer. What is your topic, please, Alex Beam?
It's about a change in the mission of NASA.
Okay. Are you ready to begin the explainer?
I am, and I know since we're short on time, you know, bring in the horn.
Okay. The countdown begins now.
Okay, which really... exactly. Exactly. My feelings exactly. All right. This March, this is genuinely interesting. It's a little bit like a Matthew McConaughey movie, but still, Congress, which is always doing the wrong thing, kind of somehow did the right thing and added to NASA's mission these words, and I quote, "The search for life's origins, evolution, distribution, and future in the universe," which is fascinating because, of course, we know that Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are all kind of mini NASAs now launching their own rockets. So now part of NASA's mission basically is like the SETI thing, right, is to search for extraterrestrial, thank you, in intelligence and other forms of life. And what a great mission. And then there's a lot of blather. I mean, the journalists have contributed. There's been a lot of discoveries lately of 47 planets, 100,000 planets, the Goldilocks zone, the water. There are actually places where there may be life. And now NASA, with our tax dollars, is going to maybe go find it.
Wow. Wow. You made it.
Thank you.
That's the first time. It's the first time you've ever made it.
That's
the second time.
Raising the roof today.
So how many other planets do you think there are with life like ours? And do they look anything like us, or are they kind of like the ET characters?
You have to ask Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. I don't have.
What do you think,
answers.
Jared?
I don't know.
I think there's lots of them.
Really?
Of course. Why should we be the only ones? I mean, I'm sure there's tons of.
We need to carve out 4 hours and bring in a couple of Catholic philosophers, I think.
Yeah.
Well, there
are all those
planets with water.
Yeah, there are all those planets
surface.
With water. And the question is, you know, do they have two arms and two legs, or is it a totally different thing? Or are they crawling on the ground, or what's their deal?
No, I
saw Arrival. They're just like smoke.
Really?
They make little drawings for us.
Oh,
and they communicate in those beautiful puffs.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. I like the ET people. Remember them? Or the third. What was the movie about? You know, the third...
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Thank you very much. Those people, they had like little heads and long legs. They look kind of like stools.
It's a great column to be done on how extraterrestrials are much more appealing than humans themselves.
I love the Mars Attacks ones. They were pretty great, too.
Yeah, those are good, too. Okay. Well, Alex Bean, congratulations on finally making your explainer in the time allowed. That was wonderful.
Thank you very much for coming in.
I
your congratulations. We're doing the book club July 8th. Need to remind people.
Oh, my God.
Robert Penn Warren, all the President's Men, all the King's Men.
You know what? You know what? It's long, but it's great. I finished it. You have finished it? Oh,
yeah.
I have just started it.
It's a big opera.
Great.
I know Jared will read it just because he wants to.
Yes.
I will. I think it's 400 pages or something.
Alex Bean joins us every week. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe, and his latest book is The Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and The End of a Beautiful Friendship. Coming up, it's the first day of summer, and we're asking you if you're going to take advantage of the longest day of the year. Are you ready to dive into the season, or are you a summer Scrooge? Do you hate the beach and everything that goes with it? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Up on Boston Public Radio, Michael Flynn, one of the most chatty members of the Trump administration, has gone silent, and it has Democratic lawmakers wondering if he is cooperating with the FBI. And if that's true, what could it mean for the investigation of President Trump? National security analyst Juliette Kayyem joins for that and more. From there, we'll do a Supreme Court recap with law professor Renee Landers, from two big victories for free speech to what could be an historic win for voting rights.
I'm Jared Bowen, and for Jim Browdy, from the Department of Cognitive Dissonance, oil industry giants like ExxonMobil, Shell, BP are backing a carbon tax proposal to curb emissions. And they're calling for a consensus on climate change solutions that bridge partisan divides. GBH's science editor Heather Goldstone joins us for that. Then we open up the lines and ask you about the first day of summer. Is this your favorite day of the year, or are you a summer Scrooge? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy is on vacation, executive arts editor for WGBH. Jared Bowen is sitting in. Hello again.
Hi, still here.
You are still here, and it's kind of fun to have you here, actually. With U.S. and North Korea relations already strained, how does the death of Otto Warmbier changed things. Joining us in Studio 3 for her take on this and a bunch of other headlines is national security expert Juliet Kayyem. She's the founder of Kayyem Solutions, host of the SCIF podcast, contributor to WGBH and CNN, where every time I turn on the television, there she is, Juliet Kayyem.
Doesn't bode well for the world, no. I have to say.
No, actually, it doesn't bode well for the world because it seems every day there's some other very upsetting development. But let's start today with some continuing developments in terms of the Russia investigation.
Yes.
There's a lot of speculation that Michael Flynn, who, of course, has resigned as the president's national security advisor, was fired, I guess would be the more accurate way to put it, has been cooperating for quite some time with the FBI. What's the story?
Well, at least that is a much more persistent rumor than it had been even 2 months ago when I first raised it. Looking at Michael Flynn, his vulnerabilities, the fact that he had been fired, the fact that he likely knows something, and the fact that he had been quiet he's been quiet. No one's seen him. He hasn't been on air defending himself. Would suggest to any lawyer who knows how these cases unfold, like myself, that this was the guy who was going to talk. If you're the White House, you're most worried about Mike Flynn because you have no hold over him. He's unemployable now. He's the subject of several investigations, and if you're Mike Flynn, you're thinking, what's my way out of this? One senator did suggest that there is evidence that Flynn is talking. I agree with that. Obviously, there's going to have to be a proffer and acceptance by Robert Mueller. But if there is, if he does start talking, I think the next thing we will have to start talking about seriously as a nation is the potential that Donald Trump will begin to pardon these people.
Well, there's a Comey element here because we're also hearing now that the president has been speaking with Flynn since the firing, and there's speculation that maybe he's speaking with him to try to keep him under wraps like he was trying
to do. You're still Comey. My best friend. Still love you, Mike. Mike, I have your back. That is what people do who are worried about the person who may flip. So the fact that Flynn has said publicly, or actually has said in meetings that have gotten public, that Donald Trump is still texting him when Donald Trump talks about Mike Flynn. He views his firing as a little bit of a media lynch mob, rather than the fact that it was because he had lied to both the president and Mike Pence. And so Donald Trump's behavior becomes relevant for obstruction charges, but also for how Flynn is feeling. Now, I have been pretty public about this. We delude ourselves, and certainly this is a talking point coming out of the Trump side right now, if we think that this is just an obstruction of justice case. Robert Mueller is no dummy. He is not going to be wasting his time bringing together some of the best prosecutors across a spectrum of expertise, from financial dealings to this new guy who just got signed on who's good at getting people to turn against the conspiracy. He is not doing this for a mere obstruction charge. Now, obstruction is a big deal. I'm not denying it. But there's an underlying crimes here. We don't know if they're financial. We don't know if they're collusion. We don't know if they're about the data and data sharing with the Russians. Jay Johnson, the former head of the Secretary of Homeland Security, is testifying right now unequivocally that the evidence is that the Russians were trying to also get into state and local networks.
You know, you just mentioned that the president could start pardoning people.
Thank you for noticing.
I don't understand. We all know that Gerald Ford famously pardoned Nixon after Nixon left office and Gerald Ford became the president. And he took a lot of flack for that at the time. I thought it, in retrospect, it was the right thing to do. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, how can you pardon people?
You can preemptively. A president can for crimes or of an investigation. So. Look, I mean, what I know of Donald Trump is there's no way that he will let Jared Kushner be the subject of an indictment. There's just no way. That's just too close to the family. So when you think about how he might use the pardoning power, if he begins to get worried that Flynn's going to turn on him, he might preemptively pardon Flynn.
Would Flynn still have to testify?
So that's an interesting question, and you're going to have to ask better lawyers than me, because when I raised this online and on air, a lot of lawyers said there were all sorts of caveats and exceptions that he might still have to testify. I'm going to But, you know, still pardoning him would mean he wouldn't go to jail for potentially crimes against our democratic system. Jared, who I've long been, Jared Kushner, I've long believed, you know, is a bullseye in this, both on the financial craziness underpinning the Kushner family money, but also on the fact that he ran data for the campaign. Data is now the data manager of the campaign is now being interviewed by Mueller, you know, whether that data was shared so that the Russians would know exactly where to attack and hack. If you're Jared Kushner, if you're Donald Trump, Jared Kushner is someone that he won't allow him to be indicted. So he will pardon him. And you can do it preemptively. Yeah. I forget it's like a 19th century Supreme Court case, ex parte, and now I'm going to get it wrong. And all the lawyers, you can chime in. Someone email. There's probably good lawyers there who can email the name of the case.
Just one last thing before we move off of this, though. I know we're talking about security issues here, but politically, that's a weird thing to pardon someone preemptively.
What would you think about firing Comey or Mueller?
Well, I thought...
If he did something illegal, he has no choice.
Right.
This is how you have to perceive his actions now. And so each time he does something in which you think that is inconceivable, the only explanation becomes because something illegal was done. I don't know what that illegality is. The theory of the case, I'm willing to wait out. Could be as far as collusion, might have to do with financial dealings. I don't know. But people are trying to figure out that now. But every time Donald Trump does something that you think is unimaginable, firing Comey, potentially firing Mueller, pardoning Mike Flynn or Jared Kushner, the only animation at this stage is because he has no option. And then talking about national security and homeland security is, of course, he doesn't give a darn about the fact that the Russians hacked the election, which is just clear. I mean, we can't even, Sean Spicer wouldn't even confirm yesterday that he believes that it happened.
And in the increasingly short press briefings that no longer can be recorded or televised.
Because he's gained weight, right? Or something, right? Body shaming.
So, Juliet, you just mentioned that the former Department of Homeland Security chief, Jay Johnson, is testifying right now. He's been testifying since we've been on the air, so we
since
haven't seen any of it. He, like many now, issued a statement last night, said that they know that the Russians did not have any interference in actual ballots or counting or reporting of election results. But you just said that it seems that
there's definitely fishing.
There
was fishing expeditions. And look, people do disagree on this. Some people do think how could it possibly be that the Russians were trying to explore state and local databases, but were not able to change votes. Now, I chaired a commission for Jay Johnson on state and local vulnerabilities to cyber attacks. That our report, he asked me to do that because I have a lot of state and local expertise. That report came out in June and really did set some of the preconditions that he needed to begin to go to these state secretaries of state and say, look, your vulnerabilities for this upcoming election are quite strong. As Jay Johnson described today, he got a lot of pushback from state secretaries of state, as well as from Republicans who don't like sort of federal authority over elections, and which just sort of cracks me up. Like, you know, they're worried about, you know, federal infiltration, but the Russian infiltration is absolutely fine. Johnson does describe by the end of his testimony that some of the states realizing what was happening did ask for assistance. But there's still no sort of, you know, look, it's not unimaginable that votes were changed. I don't have any proof of it. Jay Johnson said today they don't have any proof of it. But certainly this is something that we should be concerned about.
Well, he called it also in his statement, he called the infrastructure critical. I mean, that's a major
something that he did the last week of the administration. So he rightfully, as the Obama administration rightfully, could, you know, might be criticized for why didn't you raise the alarms? Why didn't you do more given what was going on? I mean, do not forget the political climate in the summer of 2016. That would have been very, very hard to do, especially with an ongoing investigation of the Democratic candidate about her databases, right? And so it's just such a mess. And so the worst part of it, there's so many bad parts of this piece of it, but the worst part of it is the lack of interest by Sessions, by the national security apparatus, and by the president himself on trying to fix it. The president is still at the acceptance stage.
The elections are just a little more than a year and a half, a year away, actually.
Yeah.
No, it's a year and a half.
Yeah.
How long is it?
About a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Thank you very much.
For the midterms, right.
We're talking to Juliet Kayyem, our national security advisor. You know, this has been one of the saddest stories to watch. Otto Warmbier, 22-year-old college kid, goes over on a tour in North Korea. His parents let him go. Anyway, he stole supposedly a propaganda poster from his hotel, gets 15 years hard labor. Comes home, as his father said, unable to speak, recognize them, seemed in a coma.
In a coma.
And died.
Yeah.
And the family was very tough on the Obama administration, said that President Obama did next to nothing to help their situation. They praised the Trump administration for doing what they could to get their son home. My question is, what happens now to what does the Trump administration do now regarding North Korea?
Well, the North Korea strategy is always going to be dependent on China. So you saw President Trump, sort of tweet out sort of thanks to what China did to try to get Otto out. The Chinese seem to not know what he's talking about. So, I mean, they've now made statements like we actually didn't have anything to do with it. It seems to me that the only reason why the North Koreans sent him back was because they knew he was going to die. I mean, they haven't sent the other three back who might just be perfectly healthy. And the question is the North Koreans under the Obama administration, and look, I'm sympathetic to the anger of parents, so I'm not, their criticism of the Obama administration, I'm not going to criticize. The Obama administration did get out over a dozen Americans who were being held in North Korea over the course of the 8 years, I think close to a dozen. But the only reason why he came home, unfortunately, is because for whatever reason, they really did abuse him. There's no proof of abuse of other Americans who are held by North Koreans. What I don't get is why don't we have a travel ban on North Korea? I don't understand it. I'll tell you an anecdote from my own work.
Some tour.
Yeah. So there are tour companies. I don't know. Like, I'm all into people exchanges. I went to Cuba.
On my bucket list.
Yeah.
North Korea.
But actually, I did hear somebody talking about this. I think it was on NPR the other day, who was saying that it is a major bucket list item for some people because it's such a challenge to
Whatever.
Be able to go there.
Like, get over it. Like,
exactly.
Fly, jump out of an airplane. Do something safer. Jumping out of an airplane with a half parachute is safer at this stage. Let me tell you, like, even Harvard had a program. I don't think it was sponsored by Harvard, but a bunch of Kennedy schools would go, Kennedy school students where I teach would go every year. And they would form. They were all Kennedy school students. They would get one of these companies to take them. This year, I lost it. Like, the mom in me sort of came out, and when the students came to me to talk about what they should do, I literally was like, I cannot believe that you're going. They ended up actually not going on the trip. Their motivation was, of course, the motivation of eager and optimistic students that if we don't begin these people-to-people exchanges, we'll never understand each other. Your life is not worth it, my young, optimistic, idealistic friends. We should have a travel ban on North Korea, period. And the benefits to any individual person are far outweighed the risks.
But there's no sense that we're going to escalate any hostilities
or
anything like that.
No, I don't think so right now. I think actually, thankfully, President Trump's tweet suggested that we were grateful for what China could do, but that there's not going to be a detente. And therefore, the Trump administration faces the same challenge that the Obama administration faced, which is you can only push China so far. What we have to remember is at the same time that we're, hoping or relying on China, China is becoming the superpower during this time.
I mean,
as we recede from everything from climate change to trade deals, and our lack of interest in human rights, it's China that is emerging. And we don't quite see it, but the world sees it. And so our capacity to get China to move in any direction, I think, is quite limited. China will move when it wants to move. On Otto, unfortunately, it was because he was going to die that he was sent back.
talking about immigration
yeah.
now.
My favorite topic.
You saw Kevin Cullen's piece yes. in the Globe this morning about this man, John Cunningham, who's been in this country for 18 years.
Yeah.
He's an Irish immigrant,
yeah.
Was very vocal about immigration reform and trying to make the process easier for immigrants such as himself. Long story short, he's just been picked up, a business owner, paying taxes, family man,
right.
beacon of the community.
Yeah.
We, of course, have heard this story over and over again about people all over this country, restaurant owners, yeah. people who've raised their families here, have tried to be as law-abiding as possible, now being picked up. More evidence, it seems, that this the climate really has shifted.
It's totally
and there's,
shifted.
People
and
are being targeted.
Irish.
They're being targeted.
I mean,
aren't you glad that your limited yeah. Homeland Security and immigration enforcement dollars are being spent on John Cunningham? Because he really looks like an ISIS sympathizer.
I know, being Irish.
Yeah, no, but
I mean,
look.
Really, not the Irish.
Look, you know, I'll start with this caveat. We don't know the entire background, but I do know the entire background. That what has happened is ICE has been unleashed. Immigration Customs Enforcement, CBP Customs and Border Patrol. They are focused on interior enforcement. They want to get their numbers. How do they get their numbers? That the by essentially getting the people who are trying to legalize their status. In other words, why is John Cunningham known to ICE? My guess is, although I don't think it's in the column, my guess is he's trying to get his green card.
He's going through the
lawful process mm-hmm. of trying to legitimize himself. So what do you think the motivation of this is for anyone like John Cunningham across the country? It is, I am a law-abiding a person in the United States. I employ people. I have children. But the green card isn't worth it. And so therefore, we are going to have those numbers of people who are undocumented increase, not decrease, over the course of the Trump administration, whether it's one or two terms. This is the motivation is so crazy on so many levels, not just the heartlessness, but if you actually think the impact of it is all those people who are in line to regularize their status, who may have fallen out of status because it takes so long to get your green card, are not going to come forward.
Well, it makes you wonder why they would even go to the wherever federal building you have to go
yeah,
to start the
go.
Application.
Or the courtroom
and
or the police
room,
station.
Or my husband is beating
cases.
Me. Yep. You think I'm going to tell but I'm undocumented. You think I'm going to tell a cop? Hospitals, apparently ICE has been seen at hospitals figuring out if someone is in there, you know, someone who has a wound or it's so remarkably inhumane and so
easy. This is your guy. This is your guy, John
He's not my guy anymore. I've said publicly. The Politico had a story of which I'm in. The Democrats, like me, who thought that he would be an adult in the room, have essentially walked away from Kelly. He's doing nothing to satisfy any concerns of this essentially heartless state of using the immigration enforcement tools to break up families, to get lawful people like John Cunningham. Let me tell you, it's not only shameful and heartless and bad for safety and security in the long term, it's so freaking easy. These are the easy people. Right. They are legitimate people. They're not underground. They are helping other people. They're employing people. These are the people that you want to stay. And it's so easy. I was wrong, but I wasn't the only one wrong. I mean, there's a lot of people who voted for Kelly who just can't believe what has happened to him.
You know, I just wonder, is this because he wants to keep the job and he knows he needs to
yeah,
do this.
I think we deluded, yeah, I think we deluded ourselves to think yeah. that these guys aren't as ambitious as the next person. I think you saw it at the Coast Guard graduation when he made a joke about sorting the media. Like, Kelly just has drunk the Kool-Aid. I mean, in the Politico story, someone is quoted as saying he drank the Kool-Aid. He drank the Kool-Aid, and shame on him more, but Democrats do not. He is not, you know, where they're holding fire with Mattis and others. Kelly is Mr. Trump, and he has a lot of tools to really destroy the fabric of our homeland in ways that I think we're just not quite comprehending now. I will say, for public distribution, I haven't said it publicly, but I do serve on the Homeland Security Advisory Committee because I believe that good people should sit at the table, even if it's a hard table. Kelly did not. I got a letter from Kelly last week. I will no longer be on his Homeland Security Advisory Committee. I think it was too much. I mean, would you take me? I mean, if you were me, no. Of course not.
No, and I think people should read Kevin Collins' column in the Globe if they haven't, because he did a lot for the community as well when he was here.
Including lobbying for immigration reform.
Yeah. I mean, what's the incentive structure here? And this is what these guys don't, I mean, maybe they do see it, right? I mean, but the interesting thing is on your point about Irish, this is a white adult male.
Right.
Like this is a lawful male. Like this is like not your pool that when people think about illegal or undocumented immigrants or crime, they're not thinking of someone like John Cunningham.
No, because when the economy was bad in Ireland, it was like the standing joke that suddenly Boston was overrun with people with Irish,
right.
Irish accents. Everybody had an Irish nanny and everybody had an Irish.
Everyone's last name is McGovern.
Yeah. And then the economy got better and people went back and, you know, it's back and forth.
But when I was in state government, someone said, I forgot someone in the state police's name, some superintendent or someone, someone whispered to me, just say McGovern, chances are it's McGovern. I was like, okay, that's good. Well,
you know, that was kind of the big joke.
O'Reilly, Cunningham.
The stuff at County District Attorney's Office was like the map of a county, whatever, McConnell or Gonigal, whatever the heck
it is. Yeah, exactly.
Over there. I should know.
But
County
so
Cork,
it is.
Say.
It's a very, it's a, it's a, let's just say it's a very scary time to not be essentially a U.S. born citizen.
Well, let's talk about the other reasons it's a scary time. The reason you're on television all the time, naturally, like I am, is because of the increased terror attacks. We, of course, we know about the van that plowed into a group of Muslim worshippers, the man who detonated a suitcase in Brussels, which I think was just yesterday.
Yesterday,
right? I mean, that's
there
the
was
thing.
A
you
French,
lose track.
There is a French. I don't lose track. I was in a spin class yesterday when the Brussels thing happened. But the French attack that, you know, we barely report, but apparently someone did or someone rammed into a police car. Look, we are the last week of Ramadan. ISIS is on defensive. The capacity to radicalize anyone online is sort of infinite. These are weapons that are cars are relatively easy to have. Although the Brussels one is a little bit different because it looks like it was a detonation device. I think we are going to measure success by our response capacity and our capacity to limit it. But the mosque. Oh, so go ahead.
Let me just say the preemption. That's what concerns me now.
Yeah.
And I think maybe I've asked you this before, but you start to think, why weren't all of these stopped? I mean, the suitcase was only, it seemed to fizzle out rather than actually explode.
Yeah.
Of course, the van did injure people. Killed one person, right?
London?
Yeah.
Yeah, one
person. I apologize for this. It's so hard to keep
the
facts straight.
But I mean, basically, just to put it bluntly, there's been three, within a 48-hour period, there were three terrorist attacks in European cities.
But that authorities
That's
are not seeing and detecting beforehand. Why
no,
is that?
No, I mean, part of it is there's nothing to detect. In other words, there's no network. Some of these guys are common criminals who find meaning online. Some, in the case of the mosque, which I'm very, very happy that Europe is calling it a terrorist attack. It clearly is. The case of the mosque is a guy who just filled with hatred, who was not in any way sort of known to authorities, although his community where he lived, apparently they all knew that he was sort of going crazy. And I do think the attack on the mosque is different because, you know, it's like the attack on the AME, the shootings in the AME church in South Carolina. I mean, places of worship, even in this day and age, are still hopefully considered sacrosanct and places of comfort and healing. And to get people leaving Ramadan, families late at night towards the end of Ramadan as we approach Eid is just horrifying. And there's heroic stories in that story, the imam who got him and kept the
crowd
away from him. But this is terrorism. And then what you worry about if you're London is then ISIS will use this attack as a way to try to motivate Muslims in London, in England, to radicalize and use violence as a way to say, look, they want the conflict of civilizations. They want that. And we, well-meaning people across every political and religious spectrum have to just fight that tendency.
You know, as you were pointing out, it's very difficult to guard against a truck or a van or some, you know, because everybody's driving trucks and vans. You could just drive up onto the sidewalk if you were so inclined. And I was mentioning to Jared before we were on the air that they use snowplows in the city to keep cars and vans and trucks from plowing into areas where there are large gatherings like the marathon or like the tall ships or something.
I saw the tall ships. They had the trucks. Right. You get mobile barriers to try to protect it. But that's only if you know that the event is known, right? And I mean, what's Times Square? You can't do that all the time. You can't do that in Faneuil Hall. You can't, you know, you can't do that everywhere. Did I say Faneuil? Because I meant Faneuil. Sorry.
It's okay.
That was a sort of Daniel. And so, you know, part of it is just having much more nimble security apparatus that can move much quicker. But it's a challenge. When I put it that way, three cities, 2 days, three European cities in 2 days. That's a scary number right now.
So Juliet Kiam, our national security expert, this was a shocker to me, this story about this deep root database of all these voters that a Republican contractor's database that had nearly every voter. It said 200 million voters. Does that mean Jared and I and you were on this list?
It might be.
Tell us about this story and what they knew about us and what they could be doing with this information.
So there are these companies that campaigns and others pay to get data information on voters. You know, when was the, how many times are you voting in a primary, whatever. And these are public documents. What's your name, age, whatever, race. And so then that's compiled by these companies that are bought by campaigns or the DNC and the RNC. So it turns out the RNC got information from a company. The company, not the RNC, the company was storing this data on a public cloud. In other words, one that was not secure. So we have enough problems with things being hacked. This would be like literally you could somehow, I don't know how to do it, you could do it. And so, you know, conspiracy theorists will say, was that on purpose to be able to share information without having your hands dirty? Or is this just a carelessness that we're seeing across the board, not just the RNC, we saw it with the DNC. I mean, that people are just not taking this issue seriously enough about the accessibility of this data to not just foreign threats, but also blackmail or whatever else.
So what do you and Marjorie and I all have to fear as voters, and knowing that our information was there for 12 days and they have no idea who gained access to it?
Right. I don't think there's much you can do. I mean, I think it's not because it's not like the OPM breach where there would be a legal duty to notify you. Everything.
And no credit card numbers or anything.
Because
or social security
there's
numbers,
no,
which made me feel
you have
better.
No right of privacy generally from a company that uses public data to compile information from you. You're putting that out there. So the question is, is the compiled data, does the fact that it's compiled bring with it a privacy right that would not hold with each individual piece of data? And I think the answer is, it's hard to say. I mean, my gut feeling is yes. I think it would be a hard case to make, though. And that's what these companies get paid for. But it's absolutely shocking. And it's just a carelessness.
Do you have a Skiff podcast this week?
We're taping on Friday. So we'll promote it on Monday. It is, remember last week I talked about the right side of the boom?
Yes.
We're going to talk about the left side of the boom. What is prevention, especially with all these terror attacks? So we're going to be talking
to people.
To people
really quickly before
you
go.
So right side of the boom is, left side of the boom is prevention and protection, stopping bad things from happening. Right side of the boom in emergency management thinking is response, recovery, and resiliency. And so that's how the boom is the thing, right?
Yeah.
It's a terrorist attack, a hurricane. Cane and oil spill, whatever it is. So we're gonna go back and do that. I mean, we're putting out. There's just so much news. I'll be on again tonight. Apparently,
you look spectacular on CNN.
Do I?
Yes, you do.
You should thank the makeup people.
Well, they do. Thank God for the makeup people.
Thank
what
God.
I always say.
And let me just say, thank God for radio. As the two of you look at me,
exactly.
I'm like, she left the house like that.
You can just
I love
be
it.
Totally schleppy
people,
here on the radio.
People say, how come you're not at BPL? You guys are there on certain days, and I come here on Wednesday. And I was like, I don't want to dress up for these people. I would feel so much pressure. I mean, look at me. I'm in a black tank top and sweatpants.
Yeah, you do. Look, no, I try to be more dressed up at the library.
Yeah.
Jim just shows up in those crummy jeans and his T-shirt.
I would feel, I just came from a run. So this is, and I feel close enough to the two of you to have been here like this.
You look very good in your
sweatpants. We are honored.
Thank you so much, you guys. I'll see you. Yes, I will be here next week.
That's
summer starts
good.
Up.
And we'll see you in the meantime on television.
You will.
Thank
right.
you.
Julia Kayyem joins us every week. She's the founder of Kayyem Solutions, host of the Skiff podcast, and a national security analyst for GBH and CNN. Coming up, the Supreme Court's decision to take a partisan gerrymandering case is a big deal. We'll find out why. Suffolk Law professor Renee Landers joins us for that. And other news coming out of the Supreme Court. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy is on vacation. Jared Bowen is filling in. So while freedom of speech has some high-profile attacks from Charles Murray to Julius Caesar and Ann Coulter along the way, it's also had two high-profile victories this week by way of two Supreme Court decisions. Joining us to talk about this and other activities coming out of the court is Renee Landers. She's professor of law and faculty director of the Health and Biomedical Law Concentration at Suffolk University School of Law. Renee Landers, welcome back. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
Before we get to the free speech stuff, I am obsessed with gerrymandering because I think it's a huge problem in the United States of America. Actually, John King from CNN was here with us yesterday, and he's very careful to walk both sides. You don't really know his political persuasion, but he called gerrymandering a cancer on the body politic of America. And for people that aren't clear, Democrats and Republicans are guilty of this. We're very gerrymandered right here in Massachusetts. I live in Brookline now. My congressional district goes down to where I grew up, Fall River. There's very little in common. Fall River and Brookline is ridiculous. But they do that. It makes it very difficult for Republicans in Massachusetts to win all across the country because Republicans have been better at this, frankly. Republicans are not challenged unless it's by a primary person. They almost all they have guaranteed seats almost.
And they also control the legislatures.
They
and the
do.
Constitution, the United States Constitution, gives control over congressional districts to state legislatures,
which is
a very, very kind of little odd federalism component of the Constitution.
But there's something very hopeful, putting my little patriotic hat here, for the United States of America, I think, in the possibility, I don't know, maybe my hopes will be dashed, but the Supreme Court has agreed to take up this Wisconsin gerrymandering case.
Right.
Tell us about it.
Well, so, this is the classic example of what has happened recently with once in 2010, the Republicans got control of the entire government in Wisconsin, both houses of the legislature, the governorship, and were able to put through a redistricting plan that advantaged Republicans. And disproportionately, according to some analysts, were able to therefore secure even greater control in the Wisconsin legislature. And so the reason this issue is coming up now is because all these redistricting things happen after the decennial census that happens every 10 years that's required to, be conducted by the federal government, again, under the Constitution. And trying to get the rules straight now is a really important thing. Also, obviously, before the midterm elections next year would be really useful.
So what happened in Wisconsin is the Democrats, I think they got 48% of the vote statewide, but they got almost none of the representation.
Well, something like 60% of the legislative seats went to Republicans. So it seems disproportionate.
So just let me ask you one last thing. Is it significant that the Supreme Court is even agreeing to hear this case?
It is because first of all, it's in 1962 was really the first time the court decided to wade into the redistricting business at all in this case called Baker v. Carr. And it was because, inherently it's there are political choices that need to be made about these redistricting decisions. And the court was kind of reluctant to kind of intrude into that. But because of the of the abuse of districting to disenfranchise African-American voters during the 1960s. I think that's when the court decided that it should wade in. And most of the cases so far have been about using race as a way to try to, advantage or disadvantage particular groups of voters. And so this one is significant because the court has stayed away from trying to make rules about political gerrymandering based on party.
And I have one last question about this. It's pretty interesting to try to understand it, but it sounds like the court wasn't ready to hear this until there was a standard that they could use. And so the defendant or the plaintiffs, defendants have come up with the efficiency gap.
Well, actually, it's the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs have come up with that. That's great. It's hard to keep track of who's the plaintiff and the defendant in these cases. I always ask myself. Some scholars have, analyzed these things and come up with analyze districts, and if the districts end up with so heavily partisan that the votes of another party, the other party, don't really count. No matter what they do, they can't win. Or if the votes of the disadvantaged party are spread so thinly about, among the districts that they can never even win any district, they've identified certain, threshold numbers that will, probably make the ears of the listeners glaze over. But that show that then the partisan districting has gone too far. And, the court in Wisconsin that overturned the Wisconsin districts did not rely specifically on that efficiency gap analysis, although they did say that it supported the conclusion the court reached for other reasons.
But see, the reason this is such a big deal, I'm repeating myself, is that we wouldn't be able to be so extreme. If you came from a district where there was a chance of a Republican winning or a Democrat winning, people would tend to be more moderate because they wouldn't want to look like they were wing nuts on either side.
That's right.
A wonderful thing for the country.
Right. And so, it's also related to just one other class of cases, which is all these voter suppression cases, because also this week the court agreed to take this Ohio case where it's going to review the process that Ohio uses to purge voters from the voter rolls. And I just think all these cases are of a piece, because really it's about how to make people feel like their participation in the voting process, the electoral process, will make a difference. And the districting is an element of that, for the reasons that you said, Marjorie, and the ability for people to vote without, insurmountable barriers is very important as well.
So we're talking to Renee Landers from Suffolk University.
We also want to ask you about the national security ruling that just came out of the Supreme Court as well, which seems fairly straightforward about the notion of damages to people who are detained or imprisoned. But people are looking at this, and you'll tell us why, is having a much broader impact on things like the travel ban.
Sure. So this case is the Ziegler against Abbasi case that actually started in 2002 because there were a lot of mass detentions after the events of September 11th, 2001, and the FBI and immigration officials arrested a lot of hundreds of men, mostly men, primarily from South Asia and Middle Eastern countries, often based on members of the public, calling in vague complaints, oh, suspicious Middle Eastern looking person walking around my neighborhood. And according to the Department of Justice investigation of these events, the Office of Inspector General at the DOJ concluded that the government officials really indiscriminately labeled and treated all of these men as if they were terrorists without, sort of investigating their individual circumstances rather than just as ordinary immigration detainees. And they put them in, really harsh conditions in maximum security prisons and subjected them to sometimes physical violence by prison guards. These are the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint.
Said in tiny cells, I'm reading from this story, this is a Vox piece, tiny cells for 23 hours a day, strip searched over and over, disrupted when they tried to sleep, shackled, pushed, tripped, beaten by correction officers, denied the use of the telephone, deprived of their Qurans, and harassed when they tried to pray. And by the way, the people in charge of this included then FBI director, now special counsel Robert Mueller,
right,
and then Attorney General John Ashcroft. I mean, this is kind of sickening.
It is. And so the what the plaintiffs were claiming is that under the Constitution, they have a right of action. They should have a remedy for these abuses, alleged abuses of government power. And there's an old case from the early 1970s that seemed to suggest that federal officials could be subject to suit for violations of the Constitution. The court has only relied on that case, I think, two times based on an article I read by a Stanford law professor. And the court in this case has refused to extend that theory to this, quote unquote, new context where, you know, there was this national security overlay. It was a policy decision at the highest levels of government to try to try to make sure that there were no other terrorists who were present in the country after the events of 9/11. And they didn't want to extend this rule to the new context. But the problem with it is, and then they finally said that if there's going to be a remedy, that Congress needs to pass a law creating a right of action for some of these constitutional violations. So the problem that people who are interested in civil liberties and human rights have with this ruling is that what is the Constitution for if it doesn't grant positive rights? And these are actually some areas, and very few of them, in which the Constitution grants some positive rights to be, you know, treated fairly with due process when you're detained by the government. And so it's very problematic to then rely on Congress, you know, the political branches, to enforce the constitutional provisions, which might actually be politically unpopular at certain points in time. And the Constitution, the court seems to be saying, it doesn't really mean as much as we thought it meant.
We should have pointed out that these men that they rounded up were not legally in the country.
Correct.
So I would assume it would be much different were they legally here or American citizens. I mean, because they weren't even convicted of anything. They were just rounded up,
right,
thrown in jail, and essentially tortured.
Right. And so,
incredible.
So the thing is that the immigration status does raise some issues. But I mean, the court, it has never been the case that, you know, they're the gloves come off just because the people are illegally in the country.
Okay.
There are still some modicums of either statutory protections, notice about the charges against them, those kinds of things. And certainly, not to be abused. I mean, that seems to be a bedrock principle.
So because the Supreme Court was allowing this vast leeway for federal officials involving terror concerns, this leads many to believe that the Supreme Court will allow President Trump vast leeway when it comes to his travel ban.
So I would say the difference here is that one of the differences is the legal issue. Yes, the court has been prone to giving a great deal of deference to the executive branch officials in these national security kinds of cases. But the lessons of history have shown that it's very dangerous for the courts to take the executive branch at its word. The Japanese internment situation in World War II was a situation where the government, the executive branch, actually actively misled the courts, we know now, and had very little reason to certainly detain most of the people who were detained in that situation. To detain is kind of an understatement of what happened to these people. And so and then in a recent case, in one of the Guantanamo cases, Hamdi against Rumsfeld, former Justice O'Connor famously wrote that, you know, the national security deference to the executive branch is not a blank check. And so I think the travel ban is different because the travel ban asserts that there is a reason to impose this ban on people traveling from certain countries. But there are no facts to support that assertion. This is what the plaintiffs are arguing. And second, then we have, what is the true the issue of what is the true motivation of the ban, and the question of whether the president's words outside of the context of the litigation, either during the campaign or his tweets subsequently, can be used by the courts to infer an improper motive and therefore undercut the notion that there is actually some legitimate reason for the travel ban. So the national security exception, I think we it would would be a mistake for a democracy to interpret it as, you know, any reason, no reason whatsoever, the president can do whatever he wants if he asserts a national security interest. And I think that's what's at stake in the travel ban, the so-called travel ban executive order cases.
Well, here's another ruling that I think this one is fascinating because it goes all over the place. And this is the ruling against the federal government saying that the court ruled that it violated the First Amendment by refusing to register trademarks that officials consider disparaging. It came from an Asian-American rock group called The Slants. And we should point out, you might hear that and think that's terrible, but no, this is a group that was trying to reclaim the slur. They were trying to use this as a badge of honor. They couldn't get their trademark, but now they can because of this ruling. But on the other hand, people who have been very upset that the Washington Redskins haven't changed their title, Washington Redskins ownership loves this ruling.
Right. Right. So in an era when we have a very divided Supreme Court on a number of hot button social issues and perhaps on some of these national security issues, the First Amendment free speech clause is one area where we get a lot of unanimous opinions from the court. They all are convinced of the old adage, you know, the truth of the old adage, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words may never hurt me. And that the whole essence of the First Amendment is that the government cannot regulate the content of speech. The government, the issue here was, you know, the U.S., there's a statute that Congress passed that allowed the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to disallow registrations of trademarks with using disparaging terminology like the slants. And, you know, there's this whole dispute, as you point out, Jared, about the Washington Redskins. And the government tried to argue that by, you know, granting the trademark registration, it became government speech. And the government, you know, can have a point of view. It doesn't have to, it's not constrained to be neutral in all of its public statements. But the court rejected that notion that, you know, registration was just kind of a ministerial act. You know, there were a lot of other criteria that applied to whether you can register a trademark. You know, is it something somebody else is using? All of that sort of thing. And this was not government speech and the government could not rely on that exception. And there were, you know, a couple of different opinions, you know, sort of parsing finally different aspects of this First Amendment theory. But, you know, it was a unanimous decision. So I think it does really give cause for the Redskins to be optimistic.
Well, it kind of raises the question, too, of that this may be the wrong route to go.
Yeah.
That you have to sort of and obviously many people are very upset about the Washington Redskins and think it's a slur on Native Americans and stuff, that maybe you have to do this through public pressure rather than through.
Yes. I mean, I think that would be it. You know, if the Redskins really thought that they weren't going to sell stuff, you know, their,
yeah.
Paraphernalia with that logo and that name, if they weren't going to sell tickets to the games, then, you know, I think that they would change their minds. And, notably, I grew up in Illinois, right? And the, the University of Illinois mascot was, you know, Chief Illini.
Oh.
There was a longer name. And the university has decided not to use it anymore. And I think, obviously, as in all these things, there were opinions on both sides, but they were, they decided to, having the continuing controversy about it was just not useful.
You know, one last thing, Renee Landers from Suffolk University, this decision about sex offenders, I sound like I'm on the side of sex offenders, which needless to say, I am not, but you read this story about the use of Facebook and Twitter and internet accounts. I'm not sure. I mean, like I said, it seems like the sex offender has a point here, but maybe I'm wrong. Tell us about the story.
Yeah, no. So this is the Packingham against North Carolina case where a registered sex offender, he was a registered sex offender, and then he happened to post on Facebook that, he had escaped getting a traffic ticket for some reason. And then he found himself to be in trouble again for violating the conditions of his sex offender status because he used social media. And, you know, you can see, and the court acknowledged that it was not crazy to think that there should be some restrictions on being able to use social media to get in contact with underage minors.
Right.
And this is what he was accused of, having some sexual activity with a 13-year-old,
right,
when he was about 21. 20
yeah.
or 21. And so, and that that was inappropriate. But the court recognized that, you know, we live in an age where, you know, the internet is kind of essential to daily life. You know, it's very hard to apply for many jobs, to get information about, you know, anything that you might need to do or purchase without going on the internet. And that, you know, having an overly broad restriction banning all use of any kind of internet or social media was, you know, excessive and therefore violated the First Amendment. So again, this is a case, again, I think it was another unanimous decision, a case where the Supreme Court is very united in its view that the limits on speech or the ability to speak are very problematic under the Constitution.
I love listening to you. for my little head, these sometimes are so complicated, and you make it so easy to understand.
Like Margaret Marshall, we've had her in here a few times, and these complicated matters, you and she explain so that we second graders understand. You know, because they are complicated.
That's a very high compliment. Thank you very much.
I know, don't you love her?
Yeah.
Oh my
yes,
God.
I do.
Indeed. I do love her.
We all love her.
Yeah,
right.
We all love her. Thank you very much for coming in, Renee.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Renee Landers is a professor of law and a faculty director of the Health and Biomedical Law Concentration at the Suffolk University School of Law. It's great to speak with you. Coming up, the incredible shrinking website, the City of Boston's climate change data vanished from the EPA's online database. GBH's science editor Heather Goldstone joins us for that and much more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is out. Jared Bowen is in. We are going to talk with Heather Goldstone. I believe Heather Goldstone is next. Am I correct, Jared? I'm on the wrong page here.
You are correct.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I was chatting with Renee Landers, and I neglected to turn the page on my script here. So I'm back in the saddle. In a recent interview with CNBC, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry described the forces as he sees it that are affecting the Earth's temperature.
Do you believe CO2 is the primary control knob for the temperature of the Earth and for climate?
No, most likely the primary control knob is the ocean waters and the this environment that we live in. I mean, the fact is, this isn't shouldn't be a debate about, you know, is the climate changing? Is man having an effect on it? Yeah, we are. The question should be, you know, just how much and what are the policy changes that we need to make to affect that?
Now, I think it's clear to all of us that it's the environment's fault that the environment is changing. That's essentially what he seemed to be saying. So is pulling out of the Paris Agreement the right policy change? Joining us on the line for her take on this and a range of other science news is Heather Goldstone. She's WGBH's science editor and host of Living Lab. Hello, Heather Goldstone. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jared.
Hi there.
Well, we were going to start with what's going on with this climate thing that's happening tomorrow. But since we started with Rick Perry, who, of course, famously couldn't remember which departments he wanted to get rid of when he was in a debate, in the Republican debate in the previous GOP contest for president, what is he doing over there as the Department of Energy head?
Well, there's a lot going on there, but you know, in terms of his comments this week, what you just played really trotted out some amazing red herrings, I would say. Yes, the ocean is one of the biggest control knobs for our climate. That is actually a very true statement. But of course, it's kind of tuning the planet's response to the amount of greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere. So he kind of tried to sidestep that. And then the statement about and this environment we live in, I don't really know what he meant by that. But you know, yes, the environment does, you know, attenuate or exacerbate some of the effects. But in the end, it all comes back to the greenhouse gases are in the atmosphere, kind of form this blanket around the planet. The more greenhouse gases we have up there, the more heat is trapped between the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere, you know, the layers of the atmosphere. And The ocean has an effect in that the ocean is absorbing the vast majority of the extra heat that we're trapping, and it's absorbing a lot of the greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere. So it has a huge effect. But to say that it's what's causing climate change and try to ignore greenhouse gases is clearly flies in the face of a lot of science.
You know, Heather Goldstone, I read a story a few weeks ago, and I don't think we've spoken to you since, about when you talk about the ocean absorbing the heat, that something some astronomical number like 80% of the oceans in 20 years are going to be overheated to the point that we don't even know what's going to happen. I mean, 20 well, years?
There are a lot of questions, and certainly the ocean is warming faster than a lot of people expected. I mean, when you think about the immense volume of the ocean, and I can never remember how many millions, billions of gallons it actually is, right? But you think about how much energy it takes to just boil a pot of water, right? It doesn't just instantaneously boil. So there's a lag time as the ocean heats up. And yet science over the past few years has been finding that even the deepest parts of the ocean are warming faster than expected. And there are a lot of other changes that are happening in the ocean that go along with the increasing amounts of greenhouse gases that aren't just the temperature. So it's actually changing as we put more and more carbon dioxide into the ocean. The pH is changing. It's getting more acidic. Again, scientists, if you'd asked, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, even a lot of scientists didn't think that we would be able to change the pH of the ocean just because it's so big in the ways that we already have with the greenhouse gases that we've put into the atmosphere. So the changes are happening pretty quickly. And there are some species like corals in particular who are quite sensitive to the rising temperatures, who are quite sensitive to that change in acidity, there's a lot of concern that, you know, with the bleaching, the massive coral bleaching event, which is when they get too hot, they spit out the algae that live inside them and give them their color and also give them their food. Massive bleaching along the Great Barrier Reef over the past couple of years, you know, that was an event that a lot of researchers said, you know, we didn't expect to see that kind of event for maybe 30 more years. So things are happening faster even than the scientists expected.
Well, Heather Goldstone, it seems like some of what you've just described is going to be even further confirmed. Perhaps is it tomorrow when this world climate simulation is going to be happening? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the World Climate Simulation, this is something that actually has been done hundreds of times. A group called Climate Interactive paired up with this MIT professor, John Sturman, and created this simulation that's actually more a simulation of UN negotiations. But what they do is they pair a mock UN negotiation. So they bring people in who are not experts, who are not climate negotiators or climate scientists. They give them a brief intro to climate science and to whatever nation they're going to be assigned to represent in the negotiations, what some of their interests are, what some of the threats are that they face. And then they say, have at it. Pretend you're the UN and you need to figure out what to do about climate change. And they go through one of these negotiations, and then they've also created this pared down climate model, because the climate models that are actually used for research purposes to try to create some of the predictions about likely effects going into the future, those run on supercomputers. They can take a long time to spit out an answer, and they wanted something quick. So they pared down this model that basically you feed in, you know, all these countries plan to cut their emissions by 30%, whatever it is. And it will very quickly spit out, okay, well, the world will warm 2.8 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial average temperatures. That's your end result. And what that does is gives these groups an ability to kind of look and in many cases realize, oh, we thought we were doing something that was going to have a much bigger, much more beneficial effect than it really was. We're going to have to do more than we realized. And then they can go back and renegotiate to try to get a sense of what's really going to be involved in addressing these issues. And what's going to be interesting about this particular simulation, like I said, they've done these kinds of things like 660 times or something over the past several years. This is going to be the first time since President Trump announced that the U.S. will be withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement. And so instead of having a group or individual who's representing the U.S. at the federal level tomorrow, what they'll be simulating is what would a U.N. negotiation look like with only perhaps Jerry Brown, who's now been made a special envoy to the U.N. They're representing states and cities within the United States who in the past 2 weeks have stepped up and said, hey, we're still going to uphold the Paris Agreement. They can't formally be part of the agreement, but they can still submit commitments to the UN. And as I said, now Jerry Brown's been made a special envoy, so it looks like he will be there at some of the upcoming talks. And so they're going to do this simulation to see, could that actually work out?
As you mentioned, it's been done more than 600 times. Are all these results used in policy? Do we see it affecting climate change?
Well, the results of these, the researchers at MIT do use them. But again, like I said, it's primarily an education tool. And I think the idea is that if you can get enough people outside those who are already doing actual UN negotiations to realize, first of all, how hard it is to negotiate a climate agreement among 195 parties, and also that things that sound like really big, dramatic actions don't necessarily have as much effect as you would think. If you can kind of get that understanding, just baseline understanding of the process out more broadly, that could maybe feed back into more successful negotiations and more successful policies.
We're talking to Heather Goldstone, WGBH science editor. You know, for people that are like me, they're getting hysterical by all these reports about what's happening with the Environmental Protection Agency. This is a very encouraging story, I think, and I'm hoping you'll tell me it is. ExxonMobil, Shell, British Petroleum, Unilever, Pepsi, General Motors, Johnson & Johnson, all these big corporations are supporting a plan to tax carbon dioxide emissions to help address climate change. So what do you make of that?
You know, I thought it was really interesting that came out, yesterday, that announcement.
Yeah.
And about the same time, there was actually a hearing going on Beacon Hill in the Senate Committee on Telecommunications and Energy. And there's another one in there, I forget, that's part of that committee. But again, on a state level. Carbon tax, as
right.
It's often called, although the one that's the couple of proposals that are pending in the Massachusetts legislature are actually technically carbon fees, not carbon taxes. But I think this is a trend we've been seeing over the past several months that's gaining momentum, which is that a lot of people are saying, okay, so we're going to throw out the Obama era policies that, first of all, weren't necessarily the Obama administration's first choice for how to address climate change. It was what they could get done with executive action only, having to bypass the Congress. So we're going to get rid of those. We're not going to have the Clean Power Plan. It looks like we might eventually withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. But look, we have this other thing over here, which is a market-based solution, which has actually been a lot of people's first choice and is inherently a conservative or kind of comes out of conservative values to do a market-based solution to this problem. And that's just say, right, we haven't been paying for the effects of the carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases that we put into the atmosphere. We need to do that. Economists call it internalizing externalities. You need to bring that into the economic system and actually account for this cost. And the one way to do that is to tax it, essentially. And we're seeing these proposals making their way to legislatures in a number of states, not just here in Massachusetts, but a handful of states around the Northeast and out on the West Coast. And then there's been this growing push. You may remember back in February, right, a couple of elder Republican statesmen, former
James Baker.
Baker among them.
Hank Paulson.
Secretaries of State and heads of the Fed who went and talked to President Trump and said, look, climate change is real and here's what we need to do about it. This is a Republican compatible strategy for addressing it. Not clear what the White House's response to that was, but this is that same group again now saying, look, it's not just Republican elder statesmen who like this idea. It's also really big businesses. And as far back as the Paris climate talks, a lot of those businesses were showing up at the Paris climate talks saying, we want the Paris agreement. And in fact, we'd actually like to have a price on carbon, not because we want more, costs in our bottom line, but because we know we need to move in this direction and we want the certainty and we want to be able to predict and see what's coming down the road so that we can at least plan for it so it's not a surprise. And a policy like that, this would give them that kind of certainty. And so that's what I've heard from businesses and those who work with business leaders on this issue is it's not that they love the idea of paying more. It's that they really want that certainty in their planning going ahead.
Well, Heather Goldstone, in this piece that I read talking about this proposal, it said that under the plan, a $40 carbon tax would be levied on emissions. We said that. But the proceeds from the tax would be returned to American people via carbon dividends. And the estimates are a family of four would receive a payment of $2,000 in the first year. This seems to me, I mean, if this means people are going to get money for this, I mean, this would seem to be the political way to sell this. I don't know how that would work, but that's what the claim is.
Yeah, right. So this is what's known as a carbon a revenue neutral carbon tax, right? And that's actually what's been proposed in Massachusetts as well. There's another version that in the Massachusetts legislature that would set aside a little bit of the money. It wouldn't be completely revenue neutral because it would set aside a little bit of the money at the state level for like a green energy revolving fund. But the one that seems to be the leading proposal at this point is revenue neutral, which means all of the money, the state kind of holds the money from these fees that it collects from businesses. And then at some point, it can be quarterly, it can be yearly, it can be whatever. The state hands that money back to taxpayers, or the feds hand that money back to American citizens, basically like a tax rebate, and say, look, here's your share of the money that was collected from businesses that were burning fossil fuels and creating carbon emissions. And
the I like it.
That would never happen.
I mean, wouldn't that be great? You get your check from Exxon and BP at the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, you know, be clear that it's not just purely extra money that you're getting in your pocket, because in part, what's going to happen is that the
prices will rise.
Going to pass some of that on, right? You're probably going to see it when you go to the pump and fill your gas tank. And so the idea here is that, you know, economists have explained it to me that you still feel that pressure when you go to the pump, that you're going to go, oh, maybe I don't need to drive that far, or maybe I need to drive 55 miles an hour to, you know, have better fuel efficiency or whatever to conserve your gasoline. And so there will be fewer emissions.
Right.
You'll still be paying a little bit more. But then you get that back later.
Well, and you know, it's kind of
like, we're not really good at budgeting on like a yearly
exactly.
level. Right. You've already spent that money. You're already thinking about that being gone. So when the money does come back, it feels like free money.
Well, here's the deal, Heather. Here's
the
deal.
That might actually boost the
economy.
It
might upset you to pay like $40 instead of $35 at the gas pump or 30. But, you know, that versus getting $2,000 in a check in one lump sum. I mean, I think lump sums are always the way to go when you're trying to persuade people to do big. It's like Obama did. There was some refund on Social Security. He did it the wrong way. He gave you like a couple of bucks every paycheck. He should have given you one lump sum. I mean, how excited is everybody about their tax refunds in April? They're beside themselves.
It's true. The argument against that I've heard from some legislators here in Massachusetts is a lot of concern about low-income families who can't necessarily wait until April to get that money back.
Yeah.
So that if their home heating bill goes up in December, or if it's more expensive for them to commute to work for 3 months, 6 months, a year, they're not going to be able to actually handle that cost, and there's going to be a disproportionate impact. And in fact, the Massachusetts proposal actually tries to compensate for that in one way, not necessarily giving the money back, you know, constantly along the way, but by making sure that lower income families will actually get kind of disproportionately more money back, that it won't just be a flat every single person, you know, divided up evenly. But in fact, knowing that lower income families would be disproportionately impacted by the price increases, they would also get a little bit of extra money back.
Well, Heather Goldstone, in teasing your appearance on the show, your upcoming appearance on the show, we were talking about the case of the disappearing website right here in Boston, which seems to be happening around the country, too. Have you solved the case of the disappearing website?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that scientists, climate scientists and journalists also got really concerned about going all the way back to last fall, right after the election, saying, oh, my goodness, President Trump has been elected. We know from campaign statements that he is not on board with the science of climate change. And there was concern that both educational websites like the EPA's website that you're kind of talking about here, that Mayor Marty Walsh has now decided to basically mirror on a Boston-based website, or whether it's actual data that maybe, you know, wouldn't actually be deleted, but just wouldn't be publicly available anymore. And so universities around the country, researchers, and actually in Canada as well, started these efforts to make sure that vulnerable climate data and other data being held by the federal government was actually backed up on servers so that if those websites, or I guess it now appears to be when those websites disappear from the federal government websites, that data and that information would still be preserved somewhere. And in this case, Mayor Marty Walsh has decided that, you know, Boston's going to be one of the places that not only holds it, but makes sure that that information is still available to the public.
So, Heather Goldstone, I'm not sure what this next piece has to do with the environment, but nonetheless, you wrote a very interesting piece about whether or not animals think about what others are thinking. Now, I have my own personal feelings about this, but you're the scientist, so tell us.
Well, so that's part of it, right? So do you think that you have a dog as a pet?
I have a dog. Always had dogs,
and,
yes.
And does your dog know what you're feeling?
Absolutely. He's in touch with my feelings. He's the best relationship I have. Completely. He understands
me. I take
me.
No exception to this.
I understand him. He understands me. He looks me. You know what's the great thing about dogs? You know, they will look you in the eyes, you know, forever. And people that have been married know that, you know, maybe for the first 6 months, maybe for the first couple of years, but there's not much long gazing in each other's eyes after 4 or 5 years. You know what I'm saying? If you want that kind of thing, you have to go to your dog.
Marjorie, when your dog is looking at you, he's just saying, give me the treat. Give me the treat.
Well,
give me
that's
the treat.
What I'm afraid of, that he really doesn't love me at all.
So
it's all about food.
Thing, right? Right. So this is the thing with trying to get at this question. We don't really question the fact that we constantly think about what other people are thinking.
Right.
We're doing that all the time. Sometimes too much, maybe, you know, and in some cases, some people, that's a problem that
they have.
They don't do it enough. but in trying to figure out, like, when did this evolve? When did this ability to think about somebody else's mind and what's going on in their mind evolve? Because some psychologists have said maybe this is what makes us human, what makes humans special and different than other animals. So other researchers are looking and saying, well, is that really true? But the trick is that those animals can't tell you, oh, well, I'm thinking about your thoughts, right?
Right.
Or I think that you're feeling this. So you have to devise these ways to actually test, well, are they thinking about what I'm feeling or thinking and what I want to do? Or do I just think they are? Because we all are convinced that our dogs, you know us and know how we're feeling. We all watch what a chimpanzee does and can immediately relate and start imposing what we would be thinking or feeling in that situation. So it's kind of this interesting conundrum of trying to figure out. And one of the tests that researchers have used is basically, you know, the trick where, you know, you're holding something in your hand or you've got something sitting on the table in front of you and somebody will come up and say, hey, look over there, and then grab whatever's in front of you.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty basic.
Yeah.
But the idea there is that they're projecting, okay, well, if I say look over there, then they'll look over there. Their attention will be distracted and then I can steal the thing. And so researchers will actually test whether chimpanzees will basically do that same thing. So they'll put something down in an area where they're, you know, one of their test animals is there, and they'll either look and like really intently focus their attention on the thing that's there and see if the chimpanzee will try to, or the monkey will try to steal it, or they'll put it down next to them and they'll look around and be acting like they're not paying any attention to it. And lo and behold, the monkeys come up and try to steal it more when they think that the people aren't paying attention. So it seems like they are doing this kind of projecting, that they understand when a person is or is not paying attention to a certain item.
That's pretty good. That's something, right?
I don't know that validates Marjorie thinking about her dog, but...
No, okay, so for the dog one, here's another interesting one. So for the dog one, they've done an experiment where, okay, you come home, the dog peed on the rug, and you walk in, and immediately the dog's like droopy ears and the tail's down, and they're, you know, whimpering, right? So are they feeling guilty because they know what they did is wrong, or are they feeling guilty because they think you're unhappy with them? And it turns out that when they test this, again, they're paying attention to your thoughts and feelings, and it looks like they are acting guilty because they think you're unhappy. Because if somebody comes, an owner comes in, if you do this, you know, kind of double-blind test, and you have the person come in and seem really happy and enthusiastic, even when the dog has peed on the rug, the dog doesn't seem guilty. So it's not that your dog has a conscience. Your dog is worried about what you think about your dog.
But I feel like I've been in situations where you walk in and before you can even realize what happened, the dog sort of slithers around the sneaks around, sheepishly looks at you like, when is he going to realize?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So maybe your dog has a conscience, or maybe it's just happened before, and the dog remembers
right.
what happened
oh, true,
in the
true.
Past.
Right.
You know?
Well, Heather, that was a good one. That was a good one. I maintain that my dog is reading everything I'm thinking. We're very close.
You have a mind-reading dog.
That's right. Thank you, Heather.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
See you later.
Heather Goldstone is GBH's science editor and the host of Living Lab. Coming up, Uber's tipping point. From an ousted CEO to a new app that will let you include gratuities, we're opening up the lines asking you if this is enough to win you over. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady's out and Jared Bowen is in. For years, Uber ruled the ride-hailing market, so much so that Uber has become a verb. But it's lost its luster recently thanks to a string of high-profile crises, which include sexual harassment at corporate offices and a succession of self-concocted PR nightmares for the CEO, Travis Kalanick, who's a real character, like the time he got in an argument with an Uber driver. We all saw that on YouTube. And he cracked a sexist joke about his ever-increasing desirability, telling a reporter for Esquire, we call that boober. Very funny. So months of being mired in the muck, Uber has started to fall out of favor, giving Lyft, its ride-sharing competitor, a lift. But with news today that Travis has been ousted, we're opening the lines asking if this changes things for you. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Are you an ethically minded person who dropped Uber when you became aware of their less virtuous business practices? Are you ready to get back, not behind the wheel, but in the back seat with news that Uber is cleaning up its act? Or did you never leave them? Did you look the other way because of the convenience? 877-301-8970. You know, we've also learned that Uber is now going to give people the opportunity to tip in three different cities across the country. And it's going to be you're going to be able to tip here in late July, I think it is. They're starting it elsewhere, but it's going to come here. But I have to admit, I'm very guilty on this on Uber, because I read these terrible things about the sexist office. I saw that terrible video of him screaming at a driver. He's really treated these drivers terribly. You know, they're basically making minimum wage. And I've been bad because, you know, you get the Uber, the guy's
yeah,
there
I'm listening,
in,
yes.
in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, yeah. 4 minutes. He tells you when he's on his way. It is so convenient. So I have been guilty. I have not been putting my money where my mouth is on Uber. So I'm glad Travis is gone, because I can feel less guilty now.
This is pretty extensive. If you start to dive into exactly what Uber has done in terms of obviously the competitive pricing, what it's doing to drivers, but some of the espionage it's done with Lyft, the interaction with Apple, and how the Uber app was still collecting information after people had deleted it on their phone. I mean, these are just horrific business practices that you're looking through. And I didn't realize that so much of the reason that Uber is so inexpensive is because they function that way by not paying the drivers a lot, obviously, and creating this terrible competition among drivers who left the taxi industry and thought that they, because they had lost business to Uber, and realizing that the industry is essentially cannibalizing itself. So these drivers still aren't making the money they're supposed to be making by going over to Uber. It's pretty extensive. It's going to take a lot to turn this company around.
Okay, so did you give up Uber and go to Lyft?
I didn't, because I'm a little challenged when it kind of, well, I just did the same thing you did. It's horrible practices.
I know.
I will say, I didn't realize the extent until I was doing the research for this show. I mean, I guess on the periphery, because I don't use Uber very often because I drive. generally just when I travel, but I'm a little challenged when it comes to the
app. Yeah, it would take you an hour to get on the Lyft app, so you didn't do it. You know, my children, I must say, are much more upstanding than I am. They switched to Lyft. But on the other hand, they never tipped Uber drivers. And I kind of always thought you got to give them a couple of bucks because even though they're not supposed to get tipped, because you're just so used to tipping people in cabs. But anyway, it's good. And they're also talking about the fact that because Uber investors subsidize a lot of the rides, that if they straighten this company out, the competitive edge that Uber had because it's cheaper than a taxi is going to go away.
And Lyft is more expensive than Uber, I believe, probably because they're doing standard business practices, and that's, again, Uber hasn't been working in such a way that you'd see why the prices would go back up. So yeah, it sounds like the industry is going to change.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you go to New York City, and cab drivers in Boston will be mad at me for saying this, but when you go to New York City, it's really fairly easy to get a cab, unless you're African American. We all know the terrible stories about how people don't pick up black people waiting for the cabs to come by and so forth. But in Boston, it is hard. You can walk for blocks before you find a cab, and you have to call the cab company, and then often you're waiting for 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, that's one of the problems for them, is that Uber comes really fast. Really fast.
Well, and I have connections to the cab industry in Newton through family, and I know it's just obliterated the business there. I mean, it's just completely taken it out from under them, which is just horrible.
Well, the other thing, we talked about this before, is when you try to take a cab to the airport, and you're always worried about time because you're worried about catching your flight, you get in a cab and they wouldn't have the transponder. So you have to wait in a long line to get through the line, the toll at the airport, or there wouldn't be an ability to pay with a credit card. That's changed for almost all cab companies now. They're on board. They've got the transponder. But I think it was the cab company wasn't responding to a changing dynamic. And a lot of young people do not have cars, and when you have the opportunity to take Uber Pool, which is fairly cheap, where are you going to go? You're going to go to – I mean, it's the T runs so poorly in Boston and is so damn slow. I know of a lot of people my children's age in their 20s that take Uber Pool to work because they can get there faster and almost as cheaply as they can on the MBTA, which is now – is it $2.75 a ride on the T? And, you know, who knows how long it could take you to get to work on the MBTA, because as we all know, the MBTA is a dicey proposition. You know, I've said this a million times. It's my favorite story of the last 5 years. The guys who ran faster than the Green Line, who started up by Boston College and raced the Green Line, and they passed it at Harvard Street because the Green Line is so slow and makes so many stops. I mean, when you have a choice, it's getting Uber Pool to work or spending an hour and a half on the Green Line or the Red Line, what are you going to do? 877-301-8970 is the number. So do you feel guilt-ridden if you've been like me using Uber despite these disgraceful stories you've read about the management and the way Travis Kalanick has run this company and the way he's treated drivers? And the fact is Bill Evans, who's the commissioner of police here, has said a million times, they will not have their drivers be fingerprinted so you know who's driving the cars. And also remember, after the first protests over the president's initial travel ban, remember when all the cabbies in New York said, hey, we're not going to JFK, we're not going to go to LaGuardia? That Uber kind of, you know, they were like scab drivers.
Right.
So, well, we'll pick up people from the airport. So they took a lot of bad publicity for that instance. Did you change from Uber? Did you stop taking Uber? And did you go to Lyft? Or were you a terrible person like me and you stayed with Uber and didn't go to Lyft? Or are you still with the taxis because you don't, you feel a loyalty to taxi companies? You don't want to put people out of business. You don't want to bankrupt people who spent tens of thousands of dollars for these medallions that are like worth less and less money. And do you feel better now that Travis is – he's not gone. He's still on the board, and he's still going to make a lot of money. But he's not going to be running the show anymore at Uber, it sounds like to me.
No. I think my Uber karma came through over the weekend, by the way, because I as we talked about earlier this week, I was in Dallas over the weekend, and I took an Uber from Dallas back to Fort Worth, where I was staying, and just got into the car. He started driving, and the heat wave that's affecting the whole Southwest right now was certainly ginning up this weekend, because it was more than 100 degrees in Dallas, and the windows were rolled down. I said, would you mind if we had the air conditioning as we're getting on the highway? He said, oh, no, I'm sorry. The air conditioning has gone out. So I spent a half hour in the Uber going from Dallas to Fort Worth, melting like a puddle in the back of this car.
That is terrible.
It was very hot.
Oh, my God. Okay, let's start with Sasha in Boston. What do you think, Sasha?
After the travel ban, and not only did they, scab the cab drivers, if I'm correct, they put an upcharge.
Yes, you're right. Yes.
More. After that, I was so turned off, and I switched to Lyft, and then all these stories came out about the culture at the Uber offices, and I have to believe it would take a long time for that culture at that office to change, but even if you get a new CEO in there, it's going to take a while for that toxic environment to change over. So I'm using Lyft.
You're a good person, Sasha, compared to me and Jared. We're disgraces. So, Sasha, tell me, any difference between the service in Lyft and the service of Uber? You just do the same thing, got the app going, they catch you quickly, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes. I haven't noticed any difference. I mean, honestly, I don't use it too much, but, same thing. It's an app. It's easy to use. The drivers are all really great point of experience. So it's like, at this point, why go back to Uber?
Sasha, thank you very much for the call.
We have Emily writing in from Cambridge, who is writing while riding in a Lyft at this very moment. She says she'll never use Uber. She says she always asks Lyft drivers if they prefer driving for Uber and Lyft, and they all unanimously say Lyft, that they treat them better and they make more money than Uber. Lyft all the way, she says.
Okay, well, we have to straighten ourselves out here.
We'll figure it out after the show.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that they've said in these stories, that the Uber drivers, they're paying for their own gas, they're paying for their own maintenance, that when they break it all down, They're making minimum wage, if that. And obviously, they've been Travis Kalanick was very anti-unions, and so the drivers are not getting a good deal, is the argument that many of them make. We are really disgraceful, Jared. We shouldn't have done this segment. Patrick from Plymouth. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, so I'm going to join both of you guys and jump on the Uber bandwagon, both as a driver and as a passenger. But what I do have to say is the amount of people that I have met as a passenger and as a driver are just so thankful for it. And
you drive for Uber?
Yeah.
Oh, you do?
I do. Yep, in Boston. I live in Plymouth, but it's worth the $20 of gas back and forth just to get up there and make, $200 in 6 hours, despite that's not with all the maintenance on the car and, the gas that I use. But I do have to say it's really about the individual drivers. And they're just out there to just make a tiny bit of extra money, and even if it is minimum wage, that means a lot to someone that's working a full-time job and, trying to raise the whole family. And that's what it's really all about. But what I can say, though, is that I've heard the same thing about Lyft drivers, is that, the drivers who both go for Uber and Lyft actually prefer Lyft as well. But the fact that they're bringing in tipping is a huge, huge addition to Uber because, you say you do 30, 40 trips in a night, say people give you an extra $1, $2, maybe someone will give you $5, that's an extra $40, $50 on top of everything. So it's nice to see them finally coming around with the time. And I wish I had it in me to hate the company so much because of all the things that are going on. But you know what? There's so many individual drivers out there that don't participate in any of that stuff and are just trying to earn a living.
Yeah.
And that's what it really comes down to. And it was a paycheck every single week, and now you can get the money out immediately if you want to, I think 3 or 4 times a week.
Patrick.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you. You said you can pull in $200 in 6 hours. That's way above minimum wage, right?
It's enormously above minimum wage.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you're willing to drive and pick up every single trip on a Friday night and a Saturday night, you could go from picking someone up to dropping them off to driving to get someone without taking a break for those entire 6 hours. It's just all on whether you want to accept that, those every single trip, and someone might not have the best rating as a passenger, but it's just about, taking everyone as, at face value and seeing, just meeting people. And I can say out of the, 300 trips that I've done, I had a couple passengers who were a little out there, but everyone was just really nice. and I made a lot of money doing it in just a few months. So,
okay.
You know, it was definitely worth it for me.
Thank you very much for the call. Gee, I wonder what I'm rated as a passenger.
You can see.
You can?
You can go on your profile and see.
Oh, I'll go look at my profile.
I only
profile.
Figured that out recently, and I thought, why am I only a 4.8? Why am I not a 5?
You're a 4.8? You know why? Because you probably didn't give big enough tips. I think that
probably.
Was it. Maybe you complain because there was no air conditioner. I would complain, too, about there being no air conditioner.
Plus degree.
Yeah. I mean, the poor Southwest is like a disaster. What was it, like 120 degrees in Arizona?
At least, yeah.
It's absolutely awful.
And then more in Palm Springs, South Valley. Let's go to Ed in Providence. Hi, Ed.
Hi. How are you folks doing today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Good.
So I just want to, as someone who's both been a passenger and a driver for all for both of those services, a couple things. First of all, there's literally no difference from the pricing standpoint of the two services. And
okay.
For the most part, you, as a Lyft driver, I was a Uber driver for almost 6 months, 3,000 trips, and a number of the sort of business behaviors really bothered me from Uber, both corporately and as well as at the individual level.
Yep.
And since making the change about a month ago, I can attest to the fact that it's been a magnificently pleasant experience on the other platform.
Oh, good.
So, Ed, I'm wondering about, if I may interrupt, I'm just wondering about what I read about that competition, how Uber kind of, especially in urban areas where it's so congested that Uber drivers find they're not necessarily getting the passengers that they want because there are so many competing. Did you find that? Or like our last caller, are you able to basically pick up whomever you want?
Not at all. I would support what the last gentleman said, particularly after they went to the Corey reports and they flushed, you know, nearly 8,000 to 9,000 drivers a few months back out of the system. So that sort of freed it up dramatically in the Boston area. And
okay.
No, I mean the biggest difference from my standpoint is the tipping basically.
Yeah.
You make anywhere from $35 to $50 additional a month. I mean a cycle a weekend or whatever off of your tipping, and you literally got nothing on the Uber side. I mean, Marjorie, you're a very odd individual from that standpoint of reaching into your pocket, because most people are like, oh, well, I'm not supposed to tip with Uber.
Yeah, right. Well, listen, I get carried away. I don't give them as much as I do cab drivers. It's terrible. I gave somebody $2.50 last night. That wasn't very good. But then it was only a short ride. So maybe it wasn't that bad. Ed, thank you for the call. I mean, my you hear this from millennials. They don't usually tip Uber drivers. Let's squeeze in one more call before we move on to summertime. Let's go to Gary in Worcester. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Uber driver, and I'm also a rider. But I have to tell you, unlike some of your previous callers, the fares that they pay the drivers are ridiculous. I live in Worcester, and on so many occasions, I've had riders in my car for like $4.75, $5.75 in 1 hour. So now I make the trip out to Boston, you know, get on the Mass Pike, paid $1.50 toll to get on the Mass Pike and do it in Boston. But you have to think about it in this way. We're independent contractors, right?
Right.
If you make $200 in a night, that's you. It's the car and the miles on the car and the maintenance
yep.
of the vehicle. It's way below minimum wage.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not a fan of Uber. Gary, thank you for the call. We gotta break away, but I appreciate it. Like, so I guess the bottom line here is we should all be switching to Lyft or going back to taxis.
I think it's worth it to pay attention to the business practices.
Okay, well, certainly. It will take me.
But we had a lot of people who also wrote in, I have to say, online, who said we're also using our iPhones after understanding some of Apple's practices in the manufacturing of their phones, too.
Oh, well, we're all hypocrites.
Total hypocrites.
I have an Apple MacBook Air. I mean, it's a terrible thing.
I can't talk to you anymore.
I'm sorry.
I'm just going to turn around for the rest of the show.
I have an Apple phone. Do you have an Apple phone?
I do have an iPhone.
Okay. So we're all big hypocrites. It's terrible. We're a nation of disgraces here, Jared.
We're gonna talk about happier things in a moment.
Yes, we are.
Coming up, it's the first day of summer. Is this the moment you've been waiting for or the moment you've been dreading? That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are marking the first day of summer, Jared and I, and you in New England after slogging through these winters and typically bitter springs. Summer can be particularly sweet. But of course, if you live in the Cape, you might hate the influx of tourists. You might hate the hot weather. You might not like the beach, and you might not find joy in a lobster roll either. So where are you? Are you excited that summer is here, or does it just mean the AC will be too cold at your workplace, or that you now have a household full of kids to entertain for the remainder of June and all of July and all of August when, thank God, they go back to school? The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Now, it's really too bad, Jared Bowen, that Jim Browdy's not here today, much as I love you, because Jim, like, waxes rhapsodic about the summertime. You know, the girls in their summer dresses, the people on the tee that are you can stand next to people in their summer dresses on the tee. We don't want to go too far into that subject because it makes him look like he's doing something odd. I don't think he's been on the tee in 20 years anyway. But the heat, the shimmer, the iced coffee. Well, I don't think he drinks iced coffee. He loves the summer is the bottom line. It goes on and on and on and on and on. Now, how are you about the summer?
I like the summer. See, I don't love heat, but I love the summer. Isn't that why we all live here in New England and we're in this region? Because you're so close to the water, you're close to the lakes, you're close to the oceans. You can go hiking if you want because we're close to the mountains. You have these great blue skies here. You have lobster rolls. There's just everything to love about summer, except for the heat.
Well, I like the summer. I even like the heat, which is odd because I am an Irish person. But, you know, not everybody is on the same wavelength as far as this goes. Is Maeve Higgins wrote a very funny piece in the New York Times last week, and she was talking about not liking any of it. She doesn't like the heat. She doesn't like the brightness. She doesn't like the light. She doesn't like the fact that her body is as pale as the moon, and listen to this line, heavy as the soil after rainfall. In other words, she calls herself portly. She doesn't like to have to show off her body in the summertime and take off her clothes and having people look at her. And she feels like she's much too white, which is a big problem if you are very white in the summertime because you're not supposed to get a tan anymore because of all these terrible skin cancer problems. But you know what's made me really happy today? This story from the BBC that talks about this drug. It's not on the market yet, tragically, but maybe soon we'll have it, that creates more melanin in your skin so that people with redheaded complexions like me can actually get a suntan without risking, you know, a million skin cancers. The idea is it turns your skin darker in a healthy way by adding more melanin. So if you're like Italian or you're Greek or you're you have more melanin in your skin or you're African American or something, you have that beautiful dark skin as opposed to people like me. So in a few years, I'll be able to get a tan.
Yeah, Marjorie, because that sounds brilliant to put something in your body that's going to change your skin color. I mean, what could possibly be wrong with that?
Well, it's a healthy thing. It's not
sure,
a bad thing.
Of course it is.
That's what they say. You're right. it could be a bad thing. But it is really humiliating in the summertime, you know, to just look like a big white person with spots on their skin.
That's all how you look at it. That's what everybody did around the world for so long. It was the prize of beauty to have just beautiful white porcelain skin. And it was only until the vacation industry came along and tried to get people to go to tropical regions that they started putting tan people like me with my nice tan glow and my darker complexion on travel posters.
Do you get a nice tan in the summertime?
I don't know. Yes, I do.
You do. You're very lucky. Let me tell you something. There's nothing worse than being a person with very, very white skin trying on a bathing suit under fluorescent lights to get ready to go to the beach. So what do you say at 877-301-8970? Do you love the summer? Do you hate the summer? Do you love the radiant heat coming up off the sidewalk on a really hot day? Do you dread it? Do you want to stay in an air-conditioned place? Do you want to stay with the shades down? Do you have – apparently there's a reverse – seasonal affective disorder, that there are some people who are actually, their mood is affected by the heat and the light in the summertime. The longer days do not work well for them. They just as soon it be the wintertime. I don't get that. I hate the wintertime. But there are people who feel better running around with their boots on and their hats on and their scarves on. They just don't like the summer. 877-301-8970. And the email address is bpr@wgbh.org. You're a summer person, right?
I am a summer person. I, I mean, I really don't like extreme heat, but I really think this is why we live here in New England. And I think it's that's why I try not to go away too much during the summertime, because it is just so beautiful to be here. And it's also so quick. It passes so quickly.
So quickly. And you know what's really great in the summertime is going out on a lake or in the ocean or somewhere with a float. You can float on the water and be cool. And, yeah, I mean, of course, now you have to be slathered up with sunscreen, but I love that.
And the sharks will eat your leg off.
But well, other than that. Yeah. Well, not in the lake.
No.
Isn't that great, floating?
No, I think it's beautiful. So, because I know you're missing Jim. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving you all the stuff that Jim normally gives you about these weather discussions. But I know that Jim loves to read, right, about some of the great passages. So mm-hmm. we were looking at some of the greatest odes to summer. Mm-hmm. Here's Harper Lee in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Ooh.
Summer was on the way. Gemini awaited with impatience. Summer was our best season. It was sleeping on the back screened porch and cots or trying to sleep in the treehouse. Summer was everything good to eat. It was 1,000 colors and a parched landscape. But most of all, summer was dill.
Oh, that's a great one. That's
a great one. Such a brilliant writer.
Okay, how about this? This is from Maud Hart Lovelace. I don't know who she is, but apparently she wrote something called Betsy, Tacy, and Tib. It was June, and the world smelled of roses. The sunshine was like powdered gold over the grassy hillside.
Oh.
How's that? Okay.
So when we delete our Uber apps, we'll do it outside, floating in a lake.
That's exactly right. Let's take some phone calls here. Where are we going, Jared?
Let's go to Valerie in Marblehead. Hi, Valerie.
Hi. How are you, Jared?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Oh, well, I have to tell you, I lived in Arlington, Texas for 40 years, and you cannot go to Texas between April 1st and October 1st, or you will die.
Yeah.
So we have 2 years ago, we finally moved back up here. We grew up here, and we're happy to be here, and 2 months of summer is more than enough. I don't like the heat either.
Oh, okay.
But Marblehead, it'll
heat,
be nice
Marjorie?
There.
I love the heat.
Oh,
I do. Like I say, I'm the only Irish person with the freckles that it feels like I could have been born in Aruba or something. I just absolutely love the heat. But thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call.
Don't go to Texas, Jared, in the summer.
No, it was part of a meeting. I was forced there. I don't know why they didn't do it in Chicago or somewhere else, but they decided Texas in June was great.
You know what is distressing, though, and this is something to complain about, I guess, this should not be the longest day of the year. The longest day of the year should be in July, because the days are going to get shorter now. We haven't even started on our summer vacations. The days are going to get shorter. I think it's an unfair turn of nature. July 20th or 21st should be the summer solstice.
Well, the only thing good about it, I think, is I always wake up as soon as the sun starts to come up. So right now I'm waking up often around 5:30 or something. I need that caller from yesterday who influenced her boyfriend, and now he sleeps in late. I think that's the only value to it, is that maybe it'll be a little bit darker in the morning.
But how great is it when it's still light at 8:30 at night?
Oh, it's fantastic. And you do know, so I go out to this ranch in Montana every year, and it stays light. And you find the same thing in Europe because it's more northern. It stays light until about 10 o'clock, which is just stunning and amazing. And you get to enjoy these great long summer nights.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's great.
877-301-8970. Daniel in Cambridge. What do you think, Daniel?
Hi, this is actually my first summer in New England.
Oh, so you don't know what to expect.
Well, I've been pretty disappointed so far. Before, my family is all from Florida, and I moved here from Hawaii. It seems like it's been so cold here for so long that everybody's getting worked up, and it's barely even real summer here right now.
Well, it's nice today, though, right? Isn't real summer in the 80s? I think it's in the 80s outside, isn't it? That's not bad. That's good, right?
I mean, that's April in Florida.
Oh, it's April in Florida. Well, I'll give you this, Daniel. We have had a lousy spring. I mean, it rained almost constantly during May, and there was that moment where we had the 48 degrees and everybody had to put their heat on.
that was in June.
Was it in June? Oh, God.
That happened in June.
Yeah, that's pretty odd. We can't compete with Hawaii. I mean, let's face it, Daniel. You know what I mean? You're going to be eternally disappointed. We just can't. We just can't be like Hawaii. But we're better than Texas.
Although, with this, the only great thing about all of the rain this year is I feel like we'll be as lush as Hawaii, because the gardens look better, the trees look better, the grass is greener.
That's true. Well, Daniel, I hope things improve for you. And, get down to Cape Cod. Go down to the National Seashore. That's pretty. That makes you feel pretty good about being on the Eastern Seaboard. And thank you for the call. At least the water here warms up in the summertime for the most part. You know, you can be in California. The water is pretty cold. I've never been to Hawaii. Have you been to Hawaii?
I've not been to Hawaii. That's one of my next destinations,
yeah,
I think.
On the bucket list. Yeah. Kelly and Chelsea, what do you think, Kelly?
I can't stand the weather here, winter or summer. I feel like a prisoner here. I'm a prisoner of the medical care system here.
Oh.
I am. I'm prisoner of the medical care system here. I can't stand the humidity. I can't stand the snow, the ice, the slush. I mean, I could be in Denver or I could be in L.A., but it's just I stay inside all summer long until it's dark. Then I go outside with mosquito repellent, and then I get up and I'm not kidding you. I get up as soon as the sun comes up and I go out. It's 4 in the morning, you know, when it's light, with mosquito repellent, and go out and water my garden. And I love it when it rains because then I don't have to water my garden, you know. And I go out and I do my deadheading of my 15 rose bushes and, you know, and I do all my gardening either early in the morning or late at night. And then I go in my house and I'm a prisoner of my house. I can't stand the humidity. And then in the wintertime, I don't want to go out because nobody knows how to drive anymore in the snow.
I think we need to send you to San Diego. Isn't it consistent?
San Diego, yeah.
It's consistently sunny in 70.
I was born in Santa Monica, and if I could move there tomorrow, I would. And if anybody wants to sponsor me... to move there, I'm ready to go tomorrow. I'll leave all my worldly possessions, and I will go there tomorrow if I could afford to go. But all of my doctors are here, and I have so many because I have such terrible medical problems.
Oh, Kelly, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry you're going to have a tough summer and a tough winter, and maybe the fall is good. I don't know. But, Kelly, thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call. I didn't know you have to deadhead roses. You have to deadhead roses?
Of course.
I didn't know that.
Of course. It'll help them grow. And Nancy is writing in. She says, Marjorie, in response to your comment, the longest day of the year should be the first day of autumn, which would be lovely, wouldn't it?
Yes, because then you could look forward to all summer long, the days getting lighter and lighter and lighter. And, you know, with the way the sun sets, too, it's just upsetting that the summer hasn't really formally begun yet in terms of people going on summer vacations and school still in session and stuff like that, that we're already losing the light. But thank you very much. Rick from Cambridge, what do you think, Rick?
Well, I think all of New England weather is good, and I wouldn't live anywhere else because I just don't want one season. But with regards to summer, I think the best time of the year is starting in mid-August till mid-October because you get the warm weather without the humidity. The light is actually prettier. The ocean temperature is warmer, and it is just the best time to be in New England.
And you know, sometimes I agree
Thanks,
with you because
Rick.
Sometimes you also get those really cool days that just come out of nowhere in the middle of August, and it's just yeah. all kind of cozy.
You get the hurricanes, too, though. I have learned not
to. Who are you? You could just take a beautiful comment and take me right down.
Sorry. But, I mean, having taken vacations at the end of August, I don't know why I keep doing it, because I keep doing it. And lots of times you get hurricanes in the end of August, and it kind of takes this, the fun out of everything. We got time for one more quick call. Noreed from Salem, thank you for calling.
Hey, you guys. I got out of bed this morning and put on my bathing suit and a pair of shorts. I've been lounging on the deck all day. There's a beautiful breeze coming off the water here. Every once in a while, I get up and push a broom around, but mostly I'm soaking in the sun.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's a great way to end this discussion. There is one happy woman in Salem. She's out in her deck, and she's enjoying every second of it. So
just,
there you go.
Just beware the hurricane winds, Noreed. Just beware.
Did you hear there was a tropical storm already? But mostly they come in August. Mostly they come in August. July is the best month weather-wise, wouldn't you say?
No, I agree with that other caller. I think it's mid-August. Because,
okay.
Also because that's typically when I start to go on vacation, too.
Okay.
Nice
All right.
association.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jared.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans. He's taking our questions and yours. Our crew is Chelsea Mers, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Molly Boygon, and Christina Biene. Our engineer is John LeClaire Parker. We're a production of WGBH.
So thank you very much for another brilliant day filling in for Jim Browdy, who's out, you know, slithering around in the summertime, which is his favorite thing to do. Thank you very much. You'll be back again tomorrow, correct?
I will be back again tomorrow. Now I'm going to go out and enjoy this beautiful summer day.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jared Bowen.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.